I was taught a month ago to find my time and take it slow. But then I learned just yesterday to rush and never waste the day. Now I'm convinced the whole day long that all I learn is always wrong. The things are true that I forget, but no one taught that to me yet.
I assume we're doing that's fine. We're doing the tier list first and then then me, then you. Is that right?
No, the promotional of member stuff is never before the modem sound. That's never a pre-show. It's a first topic. It's maybe a pre-topic, but it's not the pre-show.
It gets put in that section just because it ends up coming before follow-up because it's,
you know. I see. Okay. All right. Fair enough. All right. Well, I have something I want to discuss with you too. This is going to go badly for me because I'm enthusiastic about something and excited, and you two will ruin it.
Hey, but, we only do that most of the time.
Well, actually, I think, Marco, you're going to be on my side on this one mostly. I went to a concert last night, Let me just remind you once again, live music freaking rules. It's so good. Now, you're both going to hate that I went to see the Dave Matthews Band, and that's fine.
I'm not going to hate that. I'm not the Dave Matthews hater.
Okay, fair enough. But live music is so great, and there happens to be a brand new amphitheater thing at the river that runs through Richmond, as you know, many bigger, well, big-ish cities have rivers going through them, in big cities as well. But this is a brand new amphitheater that just opened this summer, and we went and saw the Dave Matthews Band there, and it was freaking great, and I love live music, despite the fact that the one qualm I have with this particular amphitheater is that it is an outdoor amphitheater right by the river, which is all well and good, in Richmond, Virginia, where it's approximately 9 million degrees and 9,000% humidity. Other than that, though, it was excellent. I was wet by the time I got home, but it was very good. And I know that, Marco, you're not a Dave Matthews fan, and that's fine. That's no problem. But I think you will at least agree with me that live music is pretty freaking great, and I just wanted to repeat that to everyone.
Yes, and with the disclaimer that you did reference Dave Matthews Band and a river, and yes, we all know about the story.
Oh, God. Oh, I didn't even think about it. Thank you for getting ahead of that. I don't need to hear it again. Oh, God.
Disclaimer, I really hate Dave Matthews Band. You're right. But I'm not sure I've ever seen a live musical act that I was hating the whole time. Like,
yeah,
I love
yeah.
live music so much mm-hmm. that while I have never been to a Dave Matthews Band show, and I'm not really in a hurry to do that, I think if for some reason I would ever find myself at a Dave Matthews Band show, I think I would have a fine time.
I think you would. I don't think you would love it by any stretch, but I think you would be just fine, like you said.
Yeah. Even anyway. If it took, you know, influences from whatever everyone else was doing around there to enjoy it.
When we got home, Aaron was like, please put your clothes directly into the washing machine. Not the laundry, mind you, directly into the washing machine.
Yes, they would stink up all the dirty laundry.
Right. Anyways, yeah. But it was very, very hot, which is a problem that I think you and I share right now.
Yes. My air conditioning is broken. Now, this is our house is all electric heat pumps for heat and AC. In the winter, the heat was broken. And I, you know, first, like, we have two separate condensers. We have one upstairs and one downstairs. And I first called service people out for the upstairs. You know, I'm like, hey, heat's broken. You know, I got the space heaters out of the basement. You know, started using space heaters as backup heat. I was like, all right, this is holding for a little while, but, like, you know, the heat's broken. We need to fix this. And, you know, had our plumber HVAC guy come out, and all, like, winter and spring, he would come out periodically and say, I think I fixed it, you know, if we got him here at all, which was always a challenge. But when he would eventually come after bothering him every single day. And now, I am not an organized person. For me to function at all in the world, I rely on technology very heavily. If I am asked by somebody, hey, come to my house tomorrow at 9, there is no way I'm doing that unless it goes into a calendar or a reminder. Like, there is no other way that's happening.
Mm-hmm.
And when I have calendar events, they have two alerts on them. They have one that's like an hour or multiple hours before, so I kind of know what's coming. And then there's another one, like, you know, 15 minutes before, when I know, okay, I gotta leave now. Because even that, if I don't have those two alerts on my calendar entries, they won't happen. Like, I won't be there. Reminders. There's always a time that they alert me. I will always tell the dingus something like, remind me tomorrow at 9 a.m. You know, that this thing has to be done today. And when those alerts come up, if I can't do it right then, I'll snooze it for, you know. And I did recently rant on Mastodon, like, the snooze options. I just hate them so much. Like, what, like, you know, if you are snoozing something at 12:30 p.m. and it says, remind me this afternoon, what does that mean? What, when is this afternoon? If you say, if it's the one I pictured, I think it was like 9 a.m. and one of the options was, remind me in the morning.
Cool.
Is that today or tomorrow?
That's
what time?
I just edit the time manually. I don't even bother with that. I just go to the reminder and change the time to be 2 hours later or whatever, exactly what I want, because I don't know what it's going to do.
But, like, on the notifications, you can't do that.
It depends. But sometimes if you tap on the notification, it'll take you to the edit thing. It's different on iPad and the phone. I know you don't care about iPad, but it annoys me that the iPad doesn't work the same way the phone does.
Oh, no. Tapping the notification itself is like a landmine to me, because I know if I tap that notification, it's gone. It will never come back up. It will never remind me again. And therefore, I won't do it. And I know there's the app Due is supposed to be better about this by, like, reminding you about stuff until
constantly
it's done.
Nagging you, yeah.
Yeah, that's, and I actually want to try that app, because I still haven't tried that app, but it sounds like I probably should. So thank you, Due fans.
You need a reminder to use Due.
Let me tell you.
I have Due remind you to never stop using it.
To build
remind
on this.
Me tomorrow at 9 a.m., install Due.
To build on this, like Marco said, I either need to be reminded or it needs to be in a calendar. And that means it either needs to be in a calendar or it needs to be in the DUE app. I cannot say enough praises about it. It is the only way that I accomplish anything in my life. Between the calendar and that, I would be lost without them.
Yeah. And so anyway, this is how I function. Plumbers and HVAC people in this area seem not to have gotten this memo. And there is literally no way to get plumbers or HVAC people. For some reason, the electricians here are good. But the plumbers and HVAC people, there is no way to get them to come fix your problem unless you talk to them that day. So you can call them and say, hey, I got this problem. Can you take on the job? And they'll be like, sure, I'll be there tomorrow. But they won't. You have to call them that morning and say, hey, are you coming today? And no matter what they say, it doesn't really matter. They will either come within a couple hours or never. And so you have to keep calling. And I hate doing this, like, because I hate being annoying to people like that. I hate being the squeaky wheel. Unfortunately, being the squeaky wheel not only works, but when dealing with this kind of person, it is often the only thing that works. And so I kind of have to force myself to be that person, which, again, I find incredibly uncomfortable. But
We need to combine our workforces because I have a reliable plumber, but no reliable electrician. You have the opposite. So we need to just make a portal or something to send workers through.
Oh, that would be amazing. So anyway, I had to eventually fire that plumber because it was like months were going by and nothing was happening. So I hired somebody else. That was a few months ago. More months went by. It's still not fixed. So today I had another company come out. This time from the mainland. Like, I'm like, all right, now I'm going to pay the big bucks to have the mainland people like get on the ferry, pay for parking. It's like, you know, hundreds of dollars just to get them here at all because they have to cover all that and all the time and everything. I'm like, all right, finally, somebody. I got here today. They had beat me here. They'd already done the work. It was fixed for 4 hours. And now So I still don't have working AC. I actually have no idea if they think they're done. They just left in the middle of the day and like didn't call me, didn't tell me anything. Like, I don't know. By the time I got here, it was after hours. So I had, you know, anyway, all this is to say, I very much appreciate air conditioning. I'm not one of these people who uses it like every single day, constantly all summer long. I like to open the windows when it's reasonable outside. It's not so reasonable in New York right now. So this is not one of those times. But I definitely very much appreciate the technology of the heat pump when it is working. And right now it is very much not working. And I even tried, I'm like, ChatGPT, is there any way I can fix this myself? And like,
no.
Yeah, like the symptom is like it blows cold air for a few hours and then doesn't blow cold air anymore. It's like, okay, well, that can be a lot of different things, none of which I can do myself. All of it's like, you know, refilling the refrigerant and stuff like that. It's like, there obviously it's not stuff that like homeowners can do. So I'm just getting by.
All right, before we leave this topic, to be clear, are you soliciting or even accepting feedback from people who are not HVAC professionals? Like,
no.
If you have a theory, are you interested? If you, the listener, has a theory, Marco, are you interested in hearing it?
Here's the thing. If you're not an HVAC professional, no, sorry. I'm also not an HVAC professional. I have my own theories. I don't need anyone else's, you know, amateur theories. My entire life is my own amateur theories. So I have plenty of those. If you're a professional, please let me know. But one thing I have found is that the people who have tried to service it so far seem not to have like the programmer debugging mindset. Now, so for instance, there's two totally separate units. They both seem to have failed in about the same way within a couple of months of each other. They're only 5 years old, and they failed in around the same way within a couple of months of each other. The second one seems to have failed after the bad guy worked on them. Now, when the new people come in and they start saying, well, it must be your third-party thermostats. I'm like, you know, I don't think it's that. Because they worked fine for 5 years. Like, they worked great for 5 years. And then all of a sudden, they both break in a similar way around the same time when they start being worked on. I don't think that's that. And, you know, so, like, there's, like, certain debugging things. It's like, okay, if they both break in the exact same way, it is probably not, like, a random fluke. Like, you know, the last guy replaced a couple of boards on them. It's like, well, was that the problem? Probably not. Like, if you look at, like, debugging, like, what's most likely? Is it likely that two different bugs on two different systems came up at around the same time and they don't talk to each other? Like, I feel like the debugging mindset of a programmer, it has not made it yet to the HVAC schools. So I hope this new company is just not done yet, and maybe I'll have air conditioning over the next few days sometime. I really hope. But we will see.
The good news is you have the ultimate redundancy insofar as you could go to the other house.
I mean, yes, but like summer's really short. Like summer is about 8 weeks in New York. Like when you don't have school, it's maybe eight to 10 weeks, I think. So even missing like a week, that's a huge chunk of the summer gone. I wait all year for this time. Like I love being here full time. That's why we moved here full time for years while my kid was in the younger school. Like I love being here full time. I don't want to just go sit in the other house like with everything closed up. Like I want to be here at the beach. That's the whole point of having the beach. So I don't like, drive me nuts.
Well, I'm sorry that you're having HVAC issues. That would drive me absolutely batty, and I would not be as chipper and chill as you are right now if I were going through that. So my apologies. The good news is your house may be warm enough that you might not need to use the oven to cook pizzas.
Good transition.
This was a hell of a lift on that transition. I'm going to pat myself on the back right quick to congratulate myself. No, we bring a pizza because we have a new member special. This is a July member special. As a reminder, if you are a member, which you can become a member by going to atp.fm/join, you can get a lot of stuff. You can get a discount on time limited merch, stuff, which just happened a couple of months ago for WWDC. You can get a bootleg, which we put up minutes after we stop talking to each other each week. You can get an ad-free version of the show, and you can get one other thing, which is member specials, which we try to do once a month. And this month, John, you brought us a member special. What did we talk about?
Talking about pizza toppings, but in our usual way. That's just too big of a topic to tackle in just a member special. How are we going to narrow it down? You'll see how we narrowed it down and the potential for future maybe tier lists or future other episodes related to this. But we took one swing at it here, ATP tier list, pizza toppings. I think it went pretty well.
Yeah, I will say this was the least violent, I think, that any of our tier lists have been.
Yeah, we came up with the very controversial opinion that pizza is good.
Who knew? No, I do mostly enjoy a violent tier list, and I do think it makes for kind of exciting programming. But I was very happy for the three of us, especially me, that we had a less violent one this time. That doesn't mean it's not worth listening to, mind you. There is still some absolute freaking insanity in this episode, but I think we did pretty well in keeping it civil.
Although I will say the feedback has been very angry.
Yes, that's true. Well, yeah. Which is funny.
But you know, that's you take what you can get.
Yeah. So ATP tier list pizza toppings. It is available to members. ATP.fm/join. Let's do some follow-up. We talked about, I don't know, it was last week, a couple weeks ago, we talked about how Meta is looking to hire AI people and looking to pay them truly bananas amounts of money, just absolutely like star athlete levels of money, $100 million or whatever. And Bloomberg has released about a week ago, a little over a week ago, they said that Ruming Pang, a distinguished engineer manager in charge of the company's Apple Foundation Models team, is leaving Apple. Pang, who joined Apple from Alphabet in 2021, is the latest big hire from Meta's new super intelligence group. To secure Pang, Meta offered a package worth tens of millions of dollars per year. One more time with feeling, tens of millions of dollars per year, the people said. At Apple, Pang had been running the Apple Foundation Models team, or AFM, a roughly 100-person team responsible for the company's large language models, which underpin Apple intelligence and other AI features on the company's devices. Pang's departure could be the start of a string of exits from the AFM group, with several engineers telling colleagues they're planning to leave in the near future to Meta or elsewhere, the people said. Tom Gunter, a top deputy to Pang, left Apple last month. Meta has also hired Wanzi Li, a researcher from OpenAI, and Anton Bakhtin, who worked on Claude at Anthropic PBC, according to other people with knowledge of the matter. Last month, it hired a slew of other OpenAI researchers.
I think the big story here is, yes, we did talk about the ridiculous salaries, I think, in an overtime in an earlier episode, but in the main episode and main part of the show in a past episode, we talked about how Apple was branching out to consider models from other companies, but still had its own in-house model group. And I thought it was really important for Apple to make sure that they keep those people. Yes, of course, they should look at other models. If their models are not up to snuff and some competitive model is better, they should license that or use it or whatever. But I thought it was still a good idea for them to have their own group and just keep working on it. Kind of like they use Qualcomm's modems for 20 years or whatever it's been, right? But eventually, when they could do their own, it is a strategically good thing to do. So I'm like, man, they really need to hold on to these people. They are not holding on to these people. when Meta's throwing that much money at them, but it seems like just a big exodus. And like, maybe Apple was trying to keep them there, trying to make counteroffers, but just it's a double whammy. So as we said when we talked about this, like, it's got to be disheartening when you're on Apple's team working on their foundation models and you're working real hard to try to make Apple's models the best they can be, and the company essentially loses faith in you or decides to go another direction and says, we're auditioning other models. We're going to try, you know, I think Claude was in lead or whatever. We're going to look at these other companies. But yeah, no, you guys keep going. It's like, oh, that feels so terrible. And then also on top of that, Meta throwing buckets of money at these people. So apparently whatever Apple has been doing to try to retain them has not been working, and a lot of important people are leaving, and that's going to be tough.
It's also interesting to me because my understanding from friends in Silicon Valley is that Apple, generally speaking, is considered, and this is not new news, but Apple's considered to be fairly cheap in a lot of ways, but including, you know, compensation, and that they don't pay their engineers, or really anyone, near as much as you would expect, and certainly as their peers. And so it is not surprising that perhaps these, you know, well sought after individuals are looking to bail in general. But then you also put on top of that, that, you know, Meta is looking to pay these ridiculous salaries. It's money talks, man. Like, I don't know if I would be able to resist if I were in their shoes.
I don't know if that's a salary or if it's like, RSUs being part of whatever. But I mean, the other thing that we've talked about is in the past episodes is that there's bitterness within Apple because the AI people are getting hired on at higher than average for Apple salaries. So like, Apple does recognize that they have to pay something closer to the market rate for people in high demand, like the AI folks. And then everyone else's Apple's like, wait a second, that guy just got hired and he's like the same level as me. Why is he making twice as much? It's like, well, he's in the AI group. And so Apple has a whole bunch of problems related to this. I mean, as we know, Apple has a whole bunch of AI-related problems, but add to it personnel problems of, like, our traditional method of, paying middle-of-the-road salaries and compensating for it with the prestige of being an Apple employee and also with our ever-increasing stock price that's worked for us, but now we're in this competitive market for AI where we're already behind and people are paying huge salaries and we've amped it up and we're paying big salaries too, but now we're sowing dissatisfaction with our own employees and we're still not keeping them. So I don't know how this shakes out. It definitely feels like a bubble, like I said. I'm not sure this is sustainable, or that I don't trust these companies to correctly know which of the individual people are actually worth tens of millions of dollars. But that's also true of hiring executives, and it hasn't stopped companies from paying executives tens of millions of dollars for years and years. And sometimes the executives just make a total mess of the company and they still get that money. So capitalism.
Well, it's also just, it's, you know, competition and value. Like, right now, AI is incredibly high value to most of these companies. And, you know, the market is supporting that. Like, regardless of what, you know, whatever you think of AI personally, the reality is it is right now hugely valuable, and everybody thinks that the value of it is only going up over time. So if you are really good AI talent that can, you know, take a company's AI position and make it a lot better, you are very valuable right now. Simple as that. Like, you know, engineering has always had different parts of it that were more or less in demand and therefore, you know, higher salary offers in the market. That whatever that is has shifted over time. Certain engineers have always been worth more if they're like on the cutting edge of whatever the current boom or bubble is about. Right now that's AI. And it's a really, really big boom or bubble. It's, you know, the valuations are very, very, very high for AI stuff right now. So these people are, at this moment, to these companies, they are worth these prices. And if Apple is going to keep being Apple and just thinking like, well, you should be honored to work for us, that's going to cost them. And, you know, whatever they are going to not pay for talent, because if they're being cheap about that, it's just going to end up with them having to pay a higher price later to acquire all these companies. So
to get the deal back. I mean, I wouldn't even, they may be giving these people counter offers that are equal to or greater. But again, if you're at Apple and they, you know, you say, well, Meta's offering me this and Apple offers you that plus 10 or whatever, you say, yeah, but Apple, you just basically, you know, changed the company's decision to not use the stuff we're working on, instead to use stuff from competitors. So I don't want to work here anymore, even if you pay me more. Like, sometimes it's a problem that you can't just solve with money. So for all we know, Apple is making, you know, competitive counter offers to Meta's offers, and the employees are just like, yeah, no, Meta told me I'd actually be able to do stuff that would actually get used. And that's, you know, for all the money, especially when you get into these big amounts of money, people want to do things that they think are actually going to ship and make a difference. They want to be on the A team, you know what I mean? They don't want to be the C team while Apple, you know, farms out the AI stuff to Anthropic or whatever.
Yeah. The other thing, too, is like, you know, it isn't necessarily just about like whether your work will ship or not. In any kind of in any of these like, you know, big technological, you know, upset slash, you know, disruption moments or waves, there are companies that are like the cool place to do those things. And there are companies that are the not cool place to do things.
Although, is Meta really the cool place for anything?
Well, if you're into cutting edge AI, it might be.
Open AI, I can see that having that attraction. Meta, I feel like people are still holding their nose to go there, but the $10 million per year or whatever makes for good nose plugs.
I mean, yeah, Meta's always been pretty good about getting over the nose holds by just throwing huge amounts of money at it. But, you know, you look at like when in the boom of the app age, you know, like 2000, you know, 8 to 2018, maybe, like in that time, the cool place to make apps was on iOS. And whether that was you working on the iOS team at a company or you working at Apple on iOS itself in some form or some app that runs, you know, that was the cool place to be. And it was pretty hard at the time for like Microsoft to get really good talent to make mobile apps for Microsoft's platforms and Microsoft's things, because it's like that wasn't the cool thing to do. Like when they launched Windows Mobile, like they had a huge problem getting anybody to care. And when you're like the uncool company in something like that, oftentimes there isn't even enough money for you to really pay people to get them to want to come work for you. Before that, with web apps, Google was like the place to be. If you wanted to like make cool stuff for the web, you went to go work for Google. And at the time, again, Microsoft is perpetually the uncool company. You know, like, even a better one, AOL. Well, like AOL had a really hard time hiring and retaining talent in the early, you know, early to mid 2000s, because they were not cool and they did not succeed on the web. They were not like doing it well. Microsoft also, honestly, was doing pretty badly on the web at that point. So if you were like a good, you know, web developer, or you wanted to work on web backend stuff, like you wouldn't want to go work for Microsoft. You'd want to go work for Google. So now you look at the AI landscape now. Even if Apple would pay good money, they have an uphill battle to get and retain good talent because Apple is an AI laughingstock. The last, if you're like a good AI researcher, I think right now Apple might be the last place you'd want to be, because it just, not only does it have like the stink of failure, but all of this action that's happening in AI, Apple is not even a player. Like they're so far behind and showing no signs of catching up, and also showing no signs of really even necessarily like respecting what's going on anywhere else. Like, you know, you look at those, you know, the interviews, especially like the interviews that Jaws did over WWDC, there's a lot of like dismissiveness and derisiveness and snideness towards the rest of the AI world in that attitude. And I think that reflects Apple's position, or at least the position of a lot of their higher up leaders. And so if you're like a cutting edge AI engineer or researcher, you don't want to go work for Apple. That they're the stink of losers who hate you. Like, why would you want that? Why, if you are like making all this cool AI stuff or researching all this cool AI stuff, why would you want to go work for a company that is both losing terribly in this market and also keeps turning their nose up at it and not giving it enough resources to succeed? Like, that's death for talent. So I am like, they have a really big uphill battle that they seem to still not really have any interest in changing. But again, I mean, what that will result in is they will eventually have to make at least one very big AI acquisition, and that's going to cost them dearly. But that's how this is going to have to go.
All right, we have all sorts of fun discoveries about Tahoe Beta 3, and this comes from Sam Henry Gold, and I skipped something. Let me try that all again. Hello.
Hey.
Hi, Future Marco.
Bye.
We have some stuff to talk about with regard to Tahoe Beta 3, beginning with FireWire using adapters. Several people have said what, John?
Doesn't work. You can plug, you can, you know, people have these fun daisy chains of like taking a really old original iPod with a FireWire adapter to FireWire 800 to Thunderbolt to, you know, I don't know. I'm missing a connector somewhere in there. Anyway, you can get it to physically connect, but because FireWire support is not in Tahoe Beta 3 and doesn't look like it's going to be in Tahoe at all, even though it physically connects, it doesn't actually work. So that kind of answers the question from earlier weeks that if you have a FireWire device and you can get an adapter, does it matter that there's a FireWire, no FireWire driver? Apparently it does.
Then we have some interesting discoveries from Sam Henry Gold, who writes, I figured out how to apply any arbitrary SF symbol to a folder in Tahoe. And there's a command that we will put in the show notes. And then apparently it also works with private symbol names. And so there's, again, a command in the show notes. Also, writes Sam, because emoji labels are just handled as strings, you can put anything in the emoji config thing. And so Sam puts a string like "Hi, Mom" on a folder, which is pretty funny.
Yeah, this is actually great because this, there, historically there's been a lot of third-party apps for doing this. Basically, I'll make you a folder icon that is embossed. Like if you know, if you look, if you put these folders in your dock or look at them in the Finder, like your home folder has always had a little house embossed on it, and the applications folder has a little A, and the documents folder has a little document. What if you'd want to have a folder, I don't know, full of like your, you know, remote control car stuff? You want a little car icon on the folder. There's been third-party apps for years and years that will make you that little custom icon, and you'll paste it onto the folder. And that works great until the next OS comes out and they change what the folder icon looks like, and all of a sudden your custom folder icon doesn't look like the rest of the folders because they all look, you know, they change the base folder icon, and when you put on a custom icon, it's the whole icon is just a big bitmap, and so it's got the old folders, right? And you have to kind of keep up with that cycle, and the app has to get updated, and you have to remember where that car icon was, and if they change the way it embosses, then the third-party app doesn't emboss it the same way that Apple does. This technique is basically add an extended attribute, com.apple.icon.folder #S, whatever that's there for. And then the value is a JSON thing that says like sim:camera.viewfinder, like an SF symbol name, or emoji colon, and then just any string. So this is an extended attribute that's on the folder. And no matter how many times Apple changes what the folders look like, if you put this extended attribute on any folder, whatever, presumably if the Apple keeps supporting this, whatever version of macOS you're running will read that extended attribute and emboss the symbol name that you put in there or the text that you put in there onto the current version of the folder. With the private symbol name thing, I'm not sure how that works because I don't even know how private SF symbols work, but can you like register your own SF symbol somewhere with the system?
There are certain symbols that Apple does not expose for use. Like one of the feedbacks I filed for this current beta cycle is the summary symbol that they use everywhere, like where Apple Intelligence summarizes notifications, that little like kind of like three lines with an arrow on one of them, like, you know, like that.
The L-shaped arrow, yeah.
Yeah, that symbol, that's an SF symbol. I believe it's actually called summary. And in fact, on the SF symbols page on Apple.com, like that advertises the app, that symbol is what they're showing in the example screenshots, and it's called summary. And that symbol is private. So there's a set of symbols that Apple uses themselves, but if apps try to use it, they don't work, and they don't show up in the SF symbols app.
All right. Well, so anyway, if you wanted to have a truly custom image, I wonder if they take like a data thing where you can put like a Base64 encoded SVG or bitmap or something. But anyway, there's so many SF symbols that surely you can find one that is appropriate for your folder. And I think the system is way better than all of the past ones, and I'm glad that they're building this in. Although this does still leave room for a third-party app to simply adopt this because people don't want to use the xadder command and stuff. So a third-party app could just, you know, say, hey, pick an SF symbol, I'll put it on a folder for you, and now it's future-proof. So I like the system. Thumbs up.
That's your next step. I was thinking the same thing.
Someone's already written it by now. It's too simple. I'm sure someone's already made it. I'm just going to use the xadder command. I'm doing this. It's not scratching itch that I have because I'm just make an alias for this and just anyway. We'll see.
All right, then Safari toolbars in Tahoe. John, it seems like you've been going on a quest to understand what's happening.
Yeah, I wish when I took the screenshots for Beta 1 that I had thought I had to be able to easily reproduce these, but I took a screenshot of like the thing that I thought was a rendering error in Safari in Tahoe Beta 1, but in reality it was just a region of the page that was showing through the toolbar in a weird way, and I thought that was terrible. And also, if you have a page that has like dark regions and light regions, the toolbar will invert because when the dark region comes below it, it has to switch from light mode to dark mode and vice versa, and it looks terrible. So in Beta 3, they've toned it down a lot. We'll put links in the show notes to Beta 1 versus Beta 3. I had to go back to this same web page and scroll it to the same position as best I could, and still I didn't get exactly right because Beta 3 has this new translate icon in the address bar. But anyway, this should basically be an apples-to-apples comparison. It's not entirely opaque. This is just the default mode, not like reduced transparency or anything. It's not entirely opaque, but it is way more opaque than it used to be. But most importantly, as far as I can tell, Beta 3 does not invert the toolbar. So if you're in light mode, the toolbar will never switch to be all black. And it also doesn't seem to honor the theme color thing. Like theguardian.com has a theme color set in their CSS that previously was telling Safari, you know, make the whole toolbar really dark navy blue, the Guardian color or whatever. Beta 3 doesn't honor that at all. And so if your toolbar, if you're in light mode, your Safari toolbar should never turn to black, either from the website asking for it or from you scrolling something underneath it. But it still will show a vague image of the thing that's scrolling behind it, which is dumb, but an improvement.
All right. And then tell me about Terminal.
Terminal tabs. I complained about these at the first beta that on the color reproduction on the M1 MacBook Air screen was insufficient for me to even tell which tab was active, as the contrast was so low that the screen could not discern between the lightish gray of the active tab and the slightly darker gray of the inactive tab. In beta 3, they have increased the contrast so that it passes that threshold. But and we'll put these two images in the show notes as well. I want you two to look in the document. You can tell that beta 3 has more contrast, right? But it's not that much more contrast.
I mean, I'll tell you, no. like in my actual use of these, I complained, like the week before beta 3 dropped, I complained about this exact problem as well from beta 2. And, in beta 2, it took some doing to tell what tab was active. In beta 3, it takes less. Like, it is more clear. It is still a very, very low contrast design in an area that I don't think that's a compliment, but it is getting more, it's getting less low contrast.
It is now discernible on an M1 MacBook Air screen, but that is a low bar.
No, and this was, to be clear, like it was almost indecipherable on a MacBook Pro screen. Like, that's what I was using on my 14-inch MacBook Pro, and it was like on the best screen Apple makes right now, it was still like impossible to see,
especially in laptop conditions. Like on my XDR, in ideal conditions with no sunlight on the screen, I could always tell on the XDR, but on the laptop, which is in the same room, it was difficult. So they're changing things. Also, I saw there was I don't have it in the notes here, but there was a plist thing you could do, like a default write command that I believe only worked with Terminal, that would revert it to like the old style tabs, not like the capsule thing. It was still low contrast, which is funny, but it's interesting that option seemed to exist, although I think it was for Terminal only, but or maybe it wasn't. Maybe it was a global one. If I find it, I'll have it in the our next episode or something. But the existence of those things like always gives people hope, like, oh, I don't like the new capsule-shaped tabs, but I can always just use this default write command, and I'll have the old tabs. If you even have that for the life of this OS, it will probably go away in a version or two, if it even makes it to release. So don't rely on that. The capsule tabs is what we're stuck with. The contrast still needs to be increased, but it's better than it was.
Also, I mean, again, like, I don't want to bash too hard on Alan Dye, but like...
Really?
Well, but this design that is ostensibly about getting out of the way of your content, if you look at Terminal under... you know, OS 26. And if you look at Terminal under Sequoia, the Terminal under Sequoia leaves more room for your content. Like, in their effort to get out of the way of your content, they are lowering information density. Everything is getting larger and bubblier and having bigger margins.
Yeah, one of the reasons for that, by the way, someone had a good screenshot that I didn't grab, but they did it on the phone, which we'll get to in a second. But they showed, like, the same app, and all they were talking about was, okay, how much room is left after we subtract out the controls for the content? And the reason, especially on the iPhone, why the OS 26s leave less room for content is the stupid rounded corners, because that requires everything to be pulled in. So if you're wondering, for example, when you go to like system settings in iOS 26, why is it so much less information dense? It's because of the curved corners, the radius of the curve. You have to keep content away from there, so you have to move it in and up. Mm-hmm. You can't nestle the, you know, essentially rectilinear text content into the corners of things. And when you have a single item with incredibly big radius on the corners, it pushes all the content in and makes it essentially mandatory margins on everything, and that makes it less information dense. And the tabs are falling victim to that as well, because they're capsules with big curves on them. And there's a border above and below. So, yeah, it's not like the words, like the text. The text in the tabs isn't any bigger. It's the stuff around it. And it's the corner radius. Corner radiuses are killing information density.
And there's more than that, too. You know, there's like, for instance, you know, their strategy for, OK, how do we make content go behind everything? They have these blurs all around the edges so that, you know, as the content gets near the top or bottom edges, it goes into a blur instead of just going to the top, or
a gradient blur where it's blurrier at the top and less blurry as you go down.
Right. what that means, though, is that like the area of your content that is fully visible and unobstructed, when you combine how high up the blur has to start with the, you know, the all the, as you were saying, like all the corner radii of everything having been expanded, and so you have to kind of pad everything more, what you end up with is kind of a tough combination of, you have the controls themselves, because they have to be so padded and get away from the edges so much, the controls horizontally are closer together. Your touch targets, if you have a toolbar that has, like, you know, say five items across the bottom, for that to adapt to this new design, it has to be further away from the edges, which means it's narrower, which means all of the touch targets for that not only have moved, but so everyone's muscle memory will be slightly broken, but they're all smaller now. They're less wide because the whole thing had to shrink in. So that's problem number one, is that the controls are closer together and harder to hit. One of the ways the design solves this is by collapsing more controls into ... menus. And, you know, the problem with that, of course, now is that everything has additional taps. You have to both tap the menu, then find the option, move your finger to it, tap that. So it's slower. It feels more cumbersome. Anyway, so you have closer together controls. You have room for fewer of them. But the amount of space that you have for your content in full view without being obstructed or blurred is actually shrinking. So you actually you need a bigger screen just to fit, you know, the same amount of stuff on screen at once. So the design ostensibly keeps, they keep saying over and over again, they're getting out of the way of our content. But in fact, they're leaving less room than ever for our content. Unless you count the blurred version of it that goes under toolbar.
No, even if you don't count the blurred version, there's still less. Like, I think someone did measurements on the Safari toolbar, which does not have a blur, or at least they had an example that didn't have a blur. Still less room. Not that it matters on Safari and the Mac, because it's such a big thing. But it just, like, even not counting the blur, they're taking up more room. And then, yes, the blur adds insult to injury.
Yeah, and to be clear, like, I hear a lot about, I hear a lot of people talking about the, you know, these designs on podcasts and YouTube and everything, and I can always tell when the people don't use it on their daily phones. It's very obvious. Like, and I'm not saying this to slag anybody, because using this on your daily phone has sucked until Beta 3, which sucks less. Beta 3 is significantly better than Betas 1 and 2. 1 and 2 were both awful. Like, real basics weren't working in Betas 1 and 2. Beta 3, I think, is the first one that I can honestly say I don't feel like a moron for having installed. I still, that's not a recommendation, to be clear, but if you must install the beta for your own curiosity or, you know, your work or whatever, beta 3 is basically fine, but betas 1 and 2 were very much not. But if you live with this design, a bunch of things become very, very clear. Number one, it is cool and it is modern. Like, that, no question. This design is cooler and it is more modern. And when you live with this design for even a few days, when you go back and look at previous apps that were made for the previous design, or when you go back and use iOS 18, it feels really dated really quickly. So I have no qualms with saying this is a cool-looking, modern-looking design. It also has significant functional problems that they are working on, that they are slowly revising. Some of them will never get revised, I don't think. Some of them we'll just have to live with, and that's fine. That's how Apple design always goes. And I think I can simultaneously say, this is a cool design, and I'm looking forward to, you know, everything evolving and looking more modern and being cooler like this in a lot of ways. I can simultaneously say that, while also saying, the things they say about this design are bullshit. It does not respect your content. It does not show off your content. It does not get out of the way of your content. It does none of the things they say. Like, Liquid Glass is all about putting controls on top of your content that blink and flash at you and are shiny and draw your attention to them. That's what this design is. It's cool. It's modern. It is terrible for showcasing your content, but it is cool and modern. So if I just take out everything they say about the design, if I try to ignore it, I actually like it a lot more. And yeah, there's a lot of revision. We'll get to it in a second. There's a lot of revision that they're doing and that they have to still do. But overall, the idea of this redesign to be refreshed and cool, they are succeeding. I think they're succeeding the least on the Mac, but that's also not a surprise. I think they have the least credibility and the least talent designing for the Mac. which is sad, but that is true. We all knew it going into this. They also care the least about the Mac. This design works the worst on the Mac. It fits the Mac the worst. And it has lots of conceptual problems on the Mac that I don't think they're going to resolve. So on the Mac, I'm a lot less of a fan of it on the Mac. On the iPhone, though, which is obviously the only platform they really gave a crap about when they designed this, it looks great. And it works okay a lot of the times. But it looks cool and it looks fresh, and I'm looking forward to that. As long as you just totally ignore all of the BS they say about it, because it is all BS. And if that's actually what they believe, they're deluding themselves. And it's very easy to prove by just using it and looking at it.
All right. iOS 26 Beta 3. A friend of the show, Dan Morin, writes, "One of the most distracting things in Liquid Glass is when you go from scrolling over light content to scrolling over dark content, and the control elements pick up the colors, which can lead to a jarring flip from light to dark. But in Beta 3, it appears to be aware of your speed. If you quickly scroll past darker content, it won't refract those colors in the controls. But if you scroll at a normal speed, it will refract them. It is an interesting way of approaching this issue." We'll put a link to his toot and a video in his toot in the show notes.
Yeah, this is actually...
I remembered to test this before beta 3, because I wondered if this was true in earlier betas, but presumably he did test it. But anyway, that's one way to avoid some of the flickering. It's like, do we have to bother with this? Or they just scroll past it real quick? But it's hiding the problem in some cases while still allowing it to be there in other cases, and it is just distracting when your controls invert. If people haven't used the OS or haven't seen these videos, it's basically switching from light mode to dark mode, and you're like, why would the controls ever need to change from light mode to dark mode? Why don't they just respect the setting that I have my phone set to? It's because the controls are showing through so much of the background that if you have a control in light mode, which is a light background with dark text, but all of a sudden the thing behind it is black, you can't have dark text on a black background. You can't read it. So the control switches to essentially dark mode, where it's light text on a dark background, and now you can read the text again. Imagine doing that in response to what is scrolling beneath it. And now they're saying, well, when you scroll fast, we won't do it. But if you scroll slowly, we will.
Yeah, that was actually, that flashing, I talked about it on the show. That was one of the worst things about betas 1 and 2. Like, it was so distracting. And it was very difficult to not constantly have your eye drawn to effectively the controls flashing very obviously at you as you would scroll down a page or a list. So this is a good change. A better change is not needing those inversions to begin with. And they actually achieve that, which I guess we're about to talk about, with some of the tweaks to where the really clear look is used in beta 3. Beta 3, so, and again, this is one of those things where, you know, the reactionary sphere, I think, overreacted to what beta 3 has done. What beta 3 has done is, in a bunch of common places, especially tab bars, which this is the navigation used in, say, the music app, where you have, like, you know, the tabs across the bottom and then the search blob, and then the mini player that can shrink into the tab bar as you scroll and everything. Tab bars in betas 1 and 2 used the very clear look, and that was one of the most common places where it would have to do this flashing back and forth between light and dark as you would scroll something colorful behind the tab bar, and you know, all of Apple's apps have these, like, accent colors that they highlight their icons with. Like, the music app, it's that kind of, like, bright pinkish color. And, you know, you put that with blurred color behind it, and it would just be totally unreadable so much of the time with so many color choices. What they've done in Beta 3 is that super clear material is no longer used in tab bars and in a few other places like that, like navigation-style places. Instead, they have frosted it pretty heavily, so much so that it doesn't need to change. So if you have a very frosted glass look, and in light mode, it's pretty light, in dark mode, it's pretty dark, and then, you know, light mode, you put black text on it, dark mode, you put white text on it. If it's frosted enough, then you can scroll any kind of color content behind it, and it won't need to flip to have enough contrast to be readable with the text. And so what they've done in Beta 3 is a lot of the places that use that super clear glass, like tab bars, they now use this kind of medium frosted glass. And it's enough that it's way more legible in practice. Now, this has led a lot of commenters who obviously are not using this regularly to say they have totally reverted Liquid Glass, or they've severely reverted it, they've withdrawn, they've gone back, how could they do this? you know, they've given in to, you know, social media or whatever, like whatever it is. I know Mark Gurman complained about that, saying they're, you know, giving in to social media complaints, which I would, you know, sidebar, I would just say social media is just people. These are just people's complaints. Like, it's not like a separate thing. It's just people. And I guarantee you it was not just people on social media who were complaining about the terrible usability of this before. But what they have done by basically frosting more of the glass does not negate the design. It is not withdrawing. Like, it is not reverting to the old design. This design is so different from iOS 18 that a simple frost level change on some of the controls does not make that big of a difference in practice. And I can tell you, again, I've been using this stupidly on my daily driver since beta 1. Don't do that, really, especially this time. It was really annoying. But when you actually use it, that does not make a very big difference in practice in a negative way. You don't, like, when I put beta 3 on, I wasn't like, oh no, liquid glass is gone. No, it's not even close to that. The design still is the design. It still holds up. They've tweaked the worst problem that gave them the most usability, legibility, and frankly design problems. They've tweaked it to make it have way fewer problems. That's good. That's design. That's design evolution. That's user testing. That's feedback. That's what's supposed to happen. Ideally, they wouldn't be doing this, you know, after they're, you know, ideally they would have done these experiments internally. And, you know, I think the reality is Apple does not have strong design leadership right now. And that's not just a slag at Alan Dye. Like, if you look at what just happened, well, you know, we'll get to it with the Jeff Williams transition and everything. Like, who is the head of design at Apple right now? Nobody. You know, so who is the head of product at Apple? Maybe Jaws? Maybe? I don't know. Maybe Jeff Williams, but not anymore? Who knows? Like, so they have to do more of this experimentation in public. That's just what happens when you have weak leadership like that in this area, or absent or missing leadership in this area. So that's what they're going to do. They're going to be doing this in public, and it is the public's job to give them feedback to say, look, this part doesn't work for us. This part is hard to read. This part's hard to use. And, you know, that then this is getting revised. But that's the process of design. That's what happens. It's not a failure of design to put something out there and then tweak it in response to feedback. That's a success of design. That is design.
Well, there's still the debate of how much of this could you cut internally, and how much of it you're going to, like, you have to choose at what point you show it to people. And when there's obvious errors that anybody could have caught internally, that's a failure, I think.
That is a failure of leadership. You know, that, and that's, again, I don't think Apple has had strong design leadership since Steve Jobs died. I think it's very, very clear that Tim Cook, for everything you can say about his operational, et cetera, you know, benefits, he has never provided strong product or design leadership or empowered people beneath him to do that.
I think Johnny Ive had some pretty strong design leadership for iOS 7. and a more successful launch, I would say. I'm going to say iOS 7 for all of, like, this tweaking the font not to be quite as fine and maybe, you know, increasing some contrast here and there, has had a smoother initial beta and feedback period than Liquid Glass. I think it's no contest.
Probably. I think the 26 series OSs are buggier than we've seen in a long time. And
just
so,
setting aside the bugs, I'm just saying, like, design feedback. Yes, there was design feedback in iOS 7, but it has been less severe. And like you said, with all these changes that you just described for beta 3, it's not like they removed the clear material.
No.
It's still there. And the places where it still exists, like someone on one of my timelines is constantly posting pictures of one of the easiest places to see the clear glass totally fall on its face. And that's the numpad for, like, dialing numbers on a telephone on your phone, like the grid of, like, 9 numbers and 0 on the bottom or whatever. That's still clear. And if you have, like, music playing in the background with an album cover that doesn't work with that, the numbers are absolutely invisible. So they're not getting rid of clear glass. It's still there. It's just that they've removed that clear glass from a very common UI element, but it's still in other places, and in the other places it still sucks.
Well, but there are some places where the clear glass can be a cool effect. They're just dramatically overusing it because they want to show off. It's cool. I get it. But, you know, that, again, the process of design oftentimes is like, look at this cool thing we're going to show off. They use it everywhere, and then you pull it back. You're like, oh, okay, actually, that's too much. It doesn't belong here. This effect is too strong here. You start pulling it back, and then you get into a more settled state. Right now, you know, they're so proud of themselves. They're really sniffing themselves on this one. They're really happy about it, you can tell, and they think they're really cool, and they went really too far. But that's what this process is, and it is our job as, quote, social media or whatever you want to call it, it is our job to give them the feedback during this time to save them from their own lack of strong design leadership, because that's what this beta is for. It's to test out what they are doing, and it isn't just testing out APIs, it's testing out the redesign also. And if the redesign totally falls over with something as common as purple album art in your music app, then they need to know that. And they should catch it earlier, but they didn't, and they won't. So, okay, we'll do it here. As long as it's happening before release, like, you know, most of the damage is being avoided. But this is the process of design. It's iteration, getting feedback, it's figuring out, like, that's the process. If they had stronger processes in place internally, we wouldn't see as much of it, but we are. Oh, well, here we are. This is the situation we've been dealt, so we'll do our best to steer it in the right direction.
All right, anything else on the betas?
I would say if you want to see the glass effect being used in a way that is both impressive and also totally dysfunctional, play a video. And, you know, look at the full screen video controls. They showed it in the keynote. You know, you can, if you like, you know, go to YouTube or whatever, play a full screen video and use the default stock player controls. I don't even know if YouTube does it, but if you like open up a video in some other app or in one of Apple's apps, play a video and you'll see the liquid glass overlay controls. And you'll see a few things. Number one, it does look really cool. Number two, it is huge and massively obstructs the content. Like, there's no, like, for them to say they're getting out of the way of the content, go look at the full screen video controls. Play a video. Pause the video. Try to seek around within it. It's comical how much the controls are yelling themselves to you. They are so in your face. They're so big. But it does look pretty cool. And I think that's just kind of the era that we're going to be in for this release. We're going to have a bunch of weird usability regressions. It's not all going to be great. Again, I think on the Mac, I think it's in a rough spot and will continue to be in a rough spot because they don't iterate this well on the Mac. When the modern era's designs get to the Mac, they arrive in a bad state. They barely iterate on them at all, and then they don't touch them for years. The Mac, I'm a little more about. But on the iPhone, it does look really cool. And so we're going to be in this era for the next year or two or three where stuff's going to look really cool and be less usable. But we're going to like it because it's going to look really cool and it looks fresh and modern. And that'll be fine for a while. And then the pendulum will swing back and we will go a little bit more towards usability. And, you know, maybe Apple's design leaders will go have some special trip in the woods and, you know, pick a new direction to go and it'll throw the pendulum in a different direction. Who knows? But for now, we're going to have some cool looking apps that are a little bit worse in usability, but we're going to appreciate that they're going to be fresh and cool.
John, you want to tell me about YouTube's new player UI?
Yeah, speaking of YouTube, you mentioned, oh, I forgot if YouTube uses the native controls or not. Well, YouTube is rolling out its own new look for its own player UI. Not the native Apple one with AV Player or whatever that you can get in various circumstances, but the YouTube native UI, when you look at YouTube in a web browser and they put the play and pause controls and the little gear menu and the closed caption thing, that interface. You'll be shocked to hear what the new YouTube player UI looks like. It looks like liquid glass.
Amazing.
Well,
this is not, your eyes do not deceive you. You haven't suddenly stealth upgraded your OS. It's not rolled out to everybody, so we'll put a link to an image in the show notes. But if you are one of the lucky few, and I apparently am, as they are either trialing this or rolling it out slowly, and you go to YouTube, you will see sort of bargain basement liquid glass-ish controls along the bottom of the video, and I don't think it looks great, but it is fulfillment of the prophecy as foretold in earlier episodes that whatever Apple does, other people very quickly copy. We talked about Flutter imitating the UI and other web frameworks doing it, and here, a fairly popular video site with a player that's probably seen by billions of people per day, going liquid glass.
I mean, it's, you know, like the MS Paint version of liquid glass.
Yeah, I mean, you know, it's not, see, that's the thing, it's not so important that they, like, look as cool or whatever. It's just, they just want to be part of, they just want to be part of the movement, you know what I mean? It's like, oh, it's a thing that Apple's doing, it's industry trend, look, we're part of it too. And you're like, yeah, I guess you are, okay, fine.
Cool. I mean, it looks like a crummy interpretation of liquid glass, which is what I would expect.
Yeah, and it is less usable because they have the same problem of like, well, what if the things behind it is light or dark and it changes the contrast? And, well, that's all part of the thing. So there you have it.
All right. The clear iPhone mock-up. This is when somebody had a phone and the phone was basically displaying what was behind on the other side of the phone. We talked about this a week or two ago. John, you had brought this to the show. And apparently we attributed it to the wrong person. Despite the phenomenal name of artisanal asparagus water, it was not by them.
I'm shocked that artisanal asparagus water was not as credible as we thought.
Yes. So, John, who brought this to us?
This apparently was made by Gavin Nelson, and that got lost in translation of the various social media things. This is originally posted to X, which explains why we may not have seen it, but there you have. Gavin Nelson made this back in April of 2025. Cool demo. Hope Apple never does it.
And then friend of the show, Guy Rambo, with regard to HDR controls in iOS 26, writes, Marco mentioned how the new HDR UI effects are limited to built-in controls provided by Apple. That's not the case with iOS 26. New APIs in UI Color and Swift UI's Color can be used to increase the quote-unquote exposure of a color, and this can be used to create effects similar to those used by Apple and system controls. Guy writes that I've made a very basic sample project to demonstrate it. We'll put a link to GitHub.
That's neat that it's not as difficult to do that, that they just simply extended the control things for this exposure thing. It was such a weird way to do it. Like, you got RGB values, you got opacity, and now exposure? Again, I feel like this whole thing of HDR is like a 1-2 trick pony. You don't get to do this forever. There's not that many levels of brightness that are comfortable for humans to look at simultaneously. Having a layer that is brighter than everything else, like the Siri layer, makes sense. Maybe there's room for one more in the middle layer, but that's basically it. You can't, there's not enough, not much more dynamic range that people comfortably want to look at on their screen. So you basically get regular brightness, super bright, and then maybe medium bright, and that even the medium bright may be a difficult sell. But anyway, if it's going to be a feature, it's nice that it is more readily accessible to third-party developers. If only someday third-party developers could do system-wide things on iOS.
I think maybe this is not such a great thing for third-party developers to have such easy access to, because, like, you know, you can see, you know, the Black Mirror version of this, where, okay,
everyone just gets brighter. It's like the loudest wars in CDs.
Yeah, like, okay, our ad is going to be a little bit brighter than everyone else's ads. And it'll perform.
Oh, for
better.
Sure they're going to do that. They already are doing that. Like the HDR ads that you see on like Instagram and stuff, already that is a thing.
Yeah, like that. Like you can see how like this will just make everything get brighter to compete for your attention more. And then it will just be, okay, now everything's just super bright.
Yeah, I mean, every technology is going to be used to annoy people, but, you know, that's life. And the good thing is, at least on iOS, most apps, you know, they're accustomed to having the whole screen to themselves anyway, so they don't have to try that hard to get your attention. They've got the whole screen. We'll see how it goes. But yeah, I think it is something they do need to build in. If they're going to use it as part of the UI, it's something the third party should have access to as well. And like any other feature, you can use it poorly or well. And so it'll be interesting to see like which apps use this to great effect, to like, you know, use just the right time and just the right amount that it adds to the app and is not like a gimmick or something that is distracting.
All right, let's do some topics, and let's start with Apple, and we alluded to this earlier. Apple has announced that their chief operating officer, Jeff Williams, is going to be transitioning to a different role soon, and that is to say he's retiring. Apple today, July 8th, announced Jeff Williams will transition his role as chief operating officer later this month to Sabig Khan, Apple senior vice president of operations, as part of a long planned succession. Williams will continue reporting to Apple CEO Tim Cook and overseeing Apple's world-class design team and Apple Watch, alongside the company's health initiatives. Apple's design team will then transition to reporting directly to Cook after Williams retires late in the year. Gruber had the following to say. Left unsaid in Apple's announcement is who will take over Williams' roles overseeing Apple Watch and health. I presume Watch will simply fall under John Ternus, who is SVP of hardware, and that Sambol Desai, who already has the title of VP of health and frequently appears during the health segments of Apple keynotes, will report directly to Cook. Mark Gurman adds, Williams has several senior design leaders reporting to him, and Apple will likely consolidate those teams under Alan Dye, hey Marco, Vice President of Human Interface, and Molly Anderson, Vice President of Industrial Design, with both reporting to Cook. The design team previously reported to Cook from 2015 to 2017.
Yeah, this is a good compare and contrast to how different senior executives leave Apple and under what circumstances. And Jeff Williams clearly essentially going out on top. He was really good at his job. The CEO really liked him. He is retiring. There is no like waffle worlds. He's not being like promoted to the roof. He's not going to become an Apple fellow. He's not in consultation. It's just a smooth transition out of the company to enjoy his well-earned riches in actual real life retirement. And I think he's like 3 years younger than Tim Cook. He's like 62 and Tim Cook is like 65 or something. Anyway, so he was always kind of the emergency backup hot spare CEO because he's so much like Tim Cook and has a lot of the same skill set and seems to be well trusted. So if like Tim Cook got hit by a bus, we just assumed that Jeff Williams would be running the company until they found a permanent CEO. But as a potential future successor to Tim Cook, doesn't really make sense because their ages are too similar. And here he is on his way out of the company. So see you, Jeff Williams. But all the stories about it have not been about like, thanks for the great work, Jeff Williams, off you go. It's been like, wait, what was the reporting structure before he left? The design team was reporting to him. And then, as Gurman points out, I think this is like after I've left, that the design team, like various heads of the design department, were reporting directly to Cook. This happens in companies of all sizes. I've experienced it myself. Like when big, important people leave the company or things get shuffled around, they're often somewhat nonsensical reporting arrangements for a surprisingly long time. It's like, oh, I guess, well, we don't know what to do. I'm not sure we're going to hire someone for this, and we're not hiring this year anyway. So I guess for now, you just report to this person or whatever. And if it goes okay, and it's like, okay, fine, I have the capacity, they can report to me for now or whatever, people just forget about it. And then you wake up 2 years later and like, how long has this person been reporting to that person? And this makes no sense. In some ways, it doesn't. It seems like it doesn't matter that much. Like, I know, Marco, you keep harping on who's the head of this and who's the head of that. In the end, Tim Cook is the head of everything. Everything is delegated. You don't necessarily need every single function to be delegated up to a single person. In fact, that is often anti-pattern, because if the subsections of your company go up to these single people, then that's like a single point of failure if they get hit by a bus, but also a single point of screwing things up. It's the Alan Dye situation, essentially. If the one decider starts making bad decisions, sometimes having a more committee-like structure with two or three peers heading a department who can fight amongst themselves works out better. But anyway, the reporting structure of having design report to Jeff Williams is like, well, what the hell does Jeff Williams know about design? He's like, he knows about as much about design as Tim Cook knows about design. But Jeff would probably say, I don't need to know anything about design. That's why we hire the world's best designers. I am above them in the org chart, and I talk to them and ask questions, and we have all these stories about him being in meetings and asking questions, but none of the stories about this have said. And then Jeff Williams said, no, I demand you do it this way, because that's not his area of expertise, and that's not what he's doing. In the end, the lack of a, you know, when you say strong leadership in design, there's leadership in design. They're just making bad decisions. And it's not Jeff Williams' fault. He's not a designer. It's the whoever is heading design below him in those meetings presenting him with things that turn out to be bad ideas that he's not pushing back against because he doesn't feel like that's his area of expertise. And honestly, it probably isn't. So when you say strong design, what you mean is designers who make better decisions. Strong as in strong skill set, not strong as in singular voice. Because honestly, I think there is a singular voice for Liquid Metal when it's Alan Dye. And for better or for worse, very often for worse. More so than when it was like, I forget it was, like Evans Hanke and somebody else who were like dual-heading design after Johnny Ive left and they were reporting to Tim Cook or whatever. But anyway, with Jeff Williams leaving, it's like, okay, so now those, I guess the design people report to Tim Cook, which is like, that's basically the same thing. Tim Cook's going to listen and ask good questions about design, but in the end, he's not going to probably have any strong opinions, and he's probably not going to push back too hard against the designers because he doesn't feel like that's his area of expertise, and it's not. So, you know, like this, all this is, I don't think this is actually an org chart problem. I think this is a who are the designers and what decisions are they making? Do we need to hire in, you know, it's kind of like John G. Andrea situation. For better or for worse, they've decided that the leadership and the AI section of the company needed to be changed. They didn't say, well, we need a strong AI leader. They had one. They just didn't get it done. So they're saying, let's try a different one or a different two. Let's try Federighi and who was the person they put in charge? Oh, Rockwell, right? Let's try those two different people instead of the previous people who were there, and hopefully we'll get a different result. Will Alan Dye ever get replaced with somebody who makes different decisions? Seems like no, until there's a new CEO. But that's the situation we're in. So I don't have any ill will towards Jeff Williams, and I don't actually think that the org chart situation was that ridiculous. I just think a lot of people are mapping their dissatisfaction with Alan Dye onto org chart issues, when in the end, if Alan Dye is still in the company, unless you hire a new person above him, which would probably make him leave, we're stuck with the Alan Dye we've got.
Yeah, I mean, I think it's very clear. As you said, like, it's up to very, very, very high up people to make changes or to, you know, delegate that in those ways. And it's either Tim Cook or somebody directly below Tim Cook who makes those kind of decisions. And Tim Cook makes the decisions for who is directly below him. And so their lack of strong, coherent design leadership for so long is ultimately Tim Cook's problem. And it seems like this change by having, I mean, it seemed like Jeff Williams, from what we have heard, and this is, we haven't heard much, you know, bits and pieces here and there. From what we've heard, Jeff Williams was leading a bunch of this stuff, but it was more of an overseeing type role rather than like giving direction per se.
Yeah, because he probably doesn't have a lot of strong opinions about, for example, design, like how it should be, you know?
Right. And it's interesting, like, you know, for a company like Apple that you think of them as having such good overall product design in so many ways, for that kind of company, you would expect there to be strong design leadership at or near the top. And for there kind of not to be, and for it to be kind of passed around here and there, is a little bit weird. But the reality is they don't have
it. Three levels down. That's pretty near the top.
Not for Apple, it's not.
Well,
like,
yeah.
For,
I mean,
for
when
design
it was Johnny Ive, it was one
Apple?
Level down.
Yeah, and of course, and that, a lot of that was, you know, Johnny was seen as like, you know, like Steve Jobs' level of clout, and it was so important, you know, both to him and internally, and also it was so important to the public, to the stock market, to the press, that, you know, when Steve died, it was so important that Apple keep Johnny, like, for image and for so many, like, you know, it was very important. And so he kind of he had free rein to a level that I think most people would never actually be given, who weren't like CEOs or founders. And the reality is that Apple, you know, when, in Johnny's departure, which I think we all know came at the right time, if not late, he was never really replaced in terms of consolidating that power. And right now, I don't think anybody who we know about, which doesn't mean nobody, but I don't think anybody we know about has clearly like the talent and the clout and the design expertise or taste expertise to be that person right now at Apple. And that's kind of what you get with, you know, 12 years of weak design leadership or whatever it's been.
I think he was too high on the org chart, though. Like, I don't think one person should have been in charge of hardware and software. And he was just under the CEO. And even in a company like Apple, I feel like that is perhaps a single person reporting to the CEO in charge of all design is too much power in too small a place. I think it should be CEO, someone like Jeff Williams, and then one, two, or three design people who make decisions that I agree with. Well, like, but like you need them to balance each other, right? Because if you give that, because I don't expect Tim Cook to say, I demand stitch leather, because he's not Steve Jobs. He doesn't have those kind of opinions, right? I don't want him to have those kind of opinions. It's not his strength. And I don't think you need the Apple CEO to have those kind of opinions. What you do need is, then there's Jeff Williams, who also doesn't have those opinions. What you do need is below that, for there to be enough people to check each other and to also have good ideas. So if one of them, you know, goes off the rails, the other two could be like, no, we're not going to do that way. they need to balance each other out. And it seems like now the problem is Tim Cook, who's not putting his oar in, Jeff Williams, same thing, mostly hands off asking questions. And then Alan Dye, who is the final decider for all liquid metal and
glass.
Who's going to disagree with Alan Dye's opinions? Not the two people above him in the org chart. And I'm sure there's tons of people below him in the org chart that disagree, but it's like, well, what are you going to do? And yeah, so I would prefer it if there was more diversity of design opinion at Apple. I don't think they need to be higher in the org chart. If they were higher in the org chart, there should definitely be two of them, not one.
I think I'm coming around. Yeah, I think I agree. You're right. You convinced me about that part. I think I'm just sad that it seems like neither the CEO nor his hot spare until moments ago, nor the people in charge of, you know, the software design at Apple, it seems like none of them are very strong product people or design people, and that kind of just makes me sad. You know, Alan Dye, I'm sure there are reasons why he has gotten where he has, but I think those were bad choices. Part of why he got where he was is that Tim Cook.
That's all the people left.
Is it, well, and Tim wow. Cook, in his infinite wisdom of, you know, design and product leadership, put too much on Johnny Ive to, you know, in order to keep him, he put hardware and software together. And hardware and software design are very different practices. And we now, you know, we have Alan Dye doing software and we have Molly Anderson doing hardware. That's great. That split should remain because those are two very different disciplines. Tim Cook made those both under Johnny. And Johnny was a very, very good hardware designer. He needed an editor, like many good artists, but he, you know, and he had that in Steve Jobs and never since. But he was very good at hardware. He was pretty terrible at software design. And that's kind of how we got the Alan Dye era, was because Johnny Ive, you know, kind of cleaned house and picked him. And the problem is, like, no one at the top seems to have really good software design skills. Like, Tim Cook, I don't think Tim Cook has ever used a computer. Johnny Ive loved the hardware so much, fancied himself a software designer, wasn't a good software designer. Alan Dye was Johnny Ive's software pick, so that's kind of where that came from. Who's left? Like, who at Apple would be a really good software designer? I don't even know if anyone's left who could.
I mean, there's probably lots of people lower down in the org chart who would be great at it, from in my opinion. Actually, I have a topic for a future episode related to this whole conundrums. I don't know how to go too far into it in this episode since we're running long, but yeah, there is a problem here. But I there is, as we've discussed in the past, it seems like a lot of the expertise and knowledge has left Apple in the past several decades for obvious good reasons: people getting old, people retiring, people getting wealthy from their stock options and retiring young. Either way, but that's just a problem Apple's got to deal with. And I continue to think, like, that a new CEO is the best potential for make different decisions here. Not a new design-focused CEO, not a new, like, oh, I have the same taste as Steve Jobs CEO, or even the same taste as Scott Forstall, who brought us that leather or whatever, right? But just, like, a new CEO who makes radically different decisions despite the fact that also they're not a good designer and also they're not a big product person. Like, it's a matter of what you value, because you don't have to be good at these things to value them and to place different priority, different importance levels on different types of things. And it seems like Tim Cook has mostly prioritized harmony and predictability over, you know, like, even look at Glass. Like, so changing the leadership in AI, it's like that raises the Tim Cook level of, like, even Tim Cook can tell we're failing here, right? But, I keep saying Liquid Metal. Look at Glass. I think no matter how Liquid Glass goes, Cook is going to think, yeah, it went okay. So no big changes are required here. Like, there's no amount of gnashing of teeth about Liquid Glass that is going to cause Tim Cook to rethink his approach to design leadership. Because in the end, it's, you know, it'll be fine. Like, it's not a big deal. It's, the usability is not great. The information density is not great. I don't think it's a great design. I don't think it's good. I don't like it. But is it the end of the world? No, it's fine. And like you said, it looks cool. And so Tim Cook, that's way below the level of his. He's gonna be like, great job, Alan. You did, you know, because he doesn't think that, like, that Apple needs to be the very best of the best in design. As long as it's not a disaster, it's probably fine. And so I think the only chance you have of any kind of, like, change in design leadership is Alan Dye retiring or a new CEO coming in and really changing priorities.
Do you think Tim Cook knows that Apple makes software?
Oh, stop. Good grief.
No, I think one thing I'm looking forward to this wave of all of this generation of Apple senior leadership slowly retiring.
Because it's happening slowly.
It's possibly slower, more slowly than it should, but it is happening. You know, time will march on and people want to retire. And so it's going to happen, you know, no matter what. And what I want to see is, you know, I'm not looking for Apple to make massive radical changes. Like, overall, they're, you know, the business is so big, the company is so big, they not only can't make big radical changes, but probably shouldn't. Like, what they have is mostly working. There are some things they need to tweak. Some of them are pretty big, like China situation. But like, overall, like, we're not looking for them to like massively change to a different kind of company or anything like that. What I want to see is, like, when you've had a certain leadership or ownership of a company or a business for a long time, the people right below them or two levels down oftentimes have great ideas of what they would do if they were in charge, but they can't convince the current leaders to do it. And a lot of times there's some really great innovations there. There's some really great kind of like finally moments there. And so when leadership transitions happen, when those number two or number three people get elevated, that's when we often see like, oh, thank God they finally changed this thing. You know, and you can see it in other tech companies. It doesn't always happen. But like, you know, one of the biggest ones of these stories, I think, is Satya Nadella.
That's the exact example I was going to pull out. And I think it's in corporate world, it's a little bit different than the political world, in that these people know how to get themselves in position so that they will be the next CEO, and they kind of like keep their powder dry. Like, they're not the person who's like railing and yelling about everything, but they do have it. They're like, I think I might do things a little differently. And they pitch their vision, like Serge Tanjga and Adela pitch the board of the vision. Here's my vision of how I'm going to do things differently than Ballmer or whatever. But they do it in a gentle way until you give them the key, and then it's like, ha, now I am actually the CEO, and actually what I'm going to do is all that stuff that I talked about, I'm really actually going to do that. And that it's a great thing to see when it's a good idea. But that's part of the thing about, like, oh, I can't know who those people are going to be, because they're not going to be the people screaming about it. If there's someone who's like in a second or third level of the org chart at Apple screaming about how they would do a better job than Tim Cook, they're never going to be CEO.
Yeah, they won't be there anymore. But like, yeah, but and like, so that's what I want to see is like, what are the Satya Nadella level ideas or transitions that will come next with Apple's next wave of leadership? And we don't know that could still be 10 years away. Who knows? But like, it's going to probably happen sometime in the next 5 to 10 years.
Yeah, Tim Cook put a cap on it, I think, a year or two ago. He said he didn't think he'd be there for the next 10 years. Everyone thinks he's just going to stay long enough to see some Apple glasses, but the clock is ticking on Tim Cook by his own words.
Right, to be clear, I'm not just talking about Tim Cook, but certainly a CEO transition, you know, that tends to...
That's where the big stuff is, because then you get to really change. Like, I mean, that's what my blog post is about. Like, how can you actually change Apple's attitude about developers? You can't have Tim Cook there anymore.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah, for that problem, definitely.
But stuff like that, like, there are certain things that you could do at a lower level of company, certain things you can't. And, you know, there's a whole bunch of important stuff that you, even the China stuff, not that I think Tim Cook is doing the wrong thing there, but like, you need the CEO to do those type of things. But these lower level design stuff could actually happen with a second or third level reshuffle, because again, Tim Cook would be like, I'm sure it's gone, it's fine. Like, if Jeff Williams get replaced by somebody who has really strong design opinions, Tim Cook won't interfere with that. I don't think it's going to happen, but it could.
No, but the reality is, like, if the CEO changes, some of the SVPs might then change. You know, that typically what happens in a leadership transition is like some of the next people down shuffle around, or, you know, some of them might leave if they wanted to be CEO, or if they don't get along with the new CEO, you know, whatever it is. Like, you know, there's oftentimes other shuffling that happens. And so that can also often result in this kind of thing. I mean, look, when Tim Cook took over Apple, you know, you had a clash between Scott Forstall and Johnny Ive, and they like couldn't work with each other, and so the new CEO had to pick one and get rid of the other one. Like, that kind of thing happens, and then look at the ramifications of that kind of thing. That's huge at a company like Apple. So that's kind of like what I want to see is like, what would, you know, Apple's Satya Nadella do? You know, would it result in, you know, I think honestly, small potatoes stuff like improving the developer relationship, which, as much as it matters to us, the small potatoes to Apple, maybe it would result in some of those things. I think the more interesting questions are probably things like, would their relationship to AI change? What about services? What about big data problems?
You know, be careful what you wish for, because an actual equivalent to Satya Nadella could be like, we're not doing the Mac anymore.
I mean, yeah.
Although you need a new CEO to make those bold decisions.
I mean, frankly, it's hard to imagine a worse CEO for the Mac than Tim Cook. Like, it's remarkable.
Well, no, if someone cancels it, that's worse.
Yes, but like, Tim Cook is so clueless about the Mac and always has
been. He really made a dog's dinner of it for a while there, but yeah. To his own credit, he did recover. I think he's had multiple recoveries on the Mac. It's a shame that he has to keep learning these same lessons, but the Mac still exists.
Yes. But anyway, I think it's going to be an exciting and interesting and scary and overall probably good transitions happening at Apple over the next decade. I think this is going to be something really to watch.
And if it's John Ternus, I really hope he got my Mac Pro shirt.
He did.
Oh, man. Can you imagine?
I wanted to read.
Incredible. I want to read one brief thing from the press release. Quote, I have a deep love for Apple. Working with all the amazing people at this company has been a privilege of a lifetime. I can't thank Tim enough for the opportunity. He's inspired inspirational leadership in our friendship over the years, said Williams. June marked my 27th anniversary with Apple and my 40th in the industry. Beginning next year, I plan to spend more time with friends and family, including 5 grandchildren and counting. I've had the pleasure of working close. Oh, blah, 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 blah. I just want to call out that they're actually talking about like family and friends in a official Apple newsroom post. I think that that's adorable, and I love this.
That's the that's the euphemism of like he's leaving to spend more time with his family when somebody got fired. But no, Jeff Williams really is.
Exactly. Legitimately is. All right. And then hello, Future Marco.
Hi.
Do we want to do the Cloudflare thing today? Do we want to wait?
We have 2 episodes next week. So I'm happy to push anything off until then, because it's going to be a little bit of a content crunch to squeeze those in.
Do you want to do the Mac control panel thing now? Or is that like too much?
No, because John will not be able to resist going on 34 tangents.
I would say we go right to your AppleCare thing.
All right, that should only take a couple minutes. Then we can wing whether or not we want to do.
I think we should do AppleCare, and then if we really have a bunch of extra time, we can go SATP. But honestly, we probably won't. It's so hot in here.
Fair enough. All right. Okay, so. I don't remember when, I'm probably not going to bother putting it in the show notes, but like a month or two ago, maybe 3 months ago, I had talked about how my AirPods Pro, Gen 2, or whatever you want to call it, Mark 2, I think we had laughed about me calling it Mark 2. This is before the USB-C, it's still Lightning. The right AirPod was not charging, particularly via Qi, and then a listener was kind enough to send me their leftover Lightning case that they had after like a repair or something like that. And that seemed to make things a touch better, but then it started to act up again. And I went to mow the lawn the other day, and I went to put in my noise-canceling AirPods Pro 2 in, and only one of them had a charge, only the left one. And that was fairly miserable. I did know enough to turn on the accessibility thing where I could turn on noise-canceling on only one AirPod, which I did, made it fine, but I was annoyed. So I go through a whole bunch of trying to troubleshoot what's going on, and I eventually say, well, I think maybe what I should do is reset my AirPods, which at the time sounded like a great idea. And what you do is we basically mash on the button on the back for like 15 seconds. And then first I unpaired them in software, on my iPhone and said, forget this device. And then I went to reset them. And now anytime I go to pair, nothing happens. And then anytime I go to re-reset them, something, and I think it's the right AirPod that otherwise seemed like it had no charge, makes 3 tones. I go boop, boop, boop. Almost like Jeopardy. And I couldn't figure out a way to resuscitate it. I tried putting them in the old case, the original case, put them back in the new case. Nothing I could do. I couldn't figure it out. So I go to the Genius Bar this morning, and I'm wearing my Dongletown, my upgrade Dongletown shirt. And they had no idea who I was, which is exactly what I expected. Nobody acknowledged my shirt, which was exactly what I expected. But at one point, they're doing diagnostics, and so they bring out most of the operation the Genius was doing on a Mac Mini, or excuse me, not a Mac Mini, a iPad Mini. But at some point, they bring out a MacBook Air that has a USB-C to USB-A dongle that then has a different dongle that I think is for troubleshooting that then is plugged into my AirPods case. So I was living in Dongletown while wearing the Dongletown t-shirt. It was amazing. I will try to remember to put a link in the show notes. It was incredible. Nobody thought this was funny but me. Nobody noticed it but I noticed. Isn't that the John Syracuse story, your biography?
So
nobody
close.
Cares but me, but I care a whole lot or something like that.
But I do
getting
care.
Getting farther away.
Yeah, sorry. So anyway... the conclusion they came to was, past Casey was not a jerk for the first time and apparently got AppleCare on this device. And apparently the AppleCare runs out in like 2 months. So excellent. I'm very excited about this. And so I assumed what that meant was I would be walking away with, at the very least, a new right AirPod, or maybe I would get like a triple word score and get a whole new set of AirPods and a new USB-C case. And it was going to be great. And then the conclusion was, no, we have to ship them away because I can't effectively perform diagnostics. Let me repeat that. They're so broken that I cannot perform diagnostics, but yet I need to ship them off to some repair center so they can do more diagnostics.
How is this worth their time?
Right. And I will acknowledge I'm about to go full Karen or whatever. Chad is the male equivalent, whatever, you know what I'm saying? And this is the first worldiest of first world problems. With that said, what is the fucking point of Apple Care if all I want to do is have problems go away and go away quickly? I am literally paying Apple for my problems to go away and go away quickly. My problem has not gone away because I still don't have AirPods, and it's not going to be quick because it's going to be between 3 and 5 business days, I think, in order to get them back. Now, the good news is they will...
You must have been a bear when you were a kid waiting for Christmas morning. Let me tell you, patience is not a virtue that you have a lot of. But
no,
I would say what you're paying for is not for your problem to go away and go away quickly. What you're paying for is not having to pay a full price for replacement AirPods. That's what you're paying for.
And that is true. But I still feel like a company, one of the most valuable companies in the world, if they can't even diagnose what's wrong with my stuff, shouldn't that be an indicator that the stuff is broken? I feel like that pretty
much indicates. Maybe it just needs to be like reset by a thing that they don't have in-house that they only have.
Then they should have it in-house,
but
right?
This is, before the age of the Apple Store, you guys don't remember, this is how every Apple warranty repair went. You wouldn't go in there and then walk out with a new item, no matter how broken your thing was. They'd always take your broken thing and ship it somewhere, and then at some point later, you would get something, either your old thing back or a new thing back. But the idea of instantaneous or cross-ship or whatever is a fairly, well, not recent, but it is a, in the age of Apple retail stores, recent innovation, and has never been standard everywhere. In fact, I think there is a fancier level of Apple Care, depending on how you contact them, or... You know, the cross shipping express thing, or if you're in a store, the manager's discretion, you could get one there and leave with it when they take your old one in and stuff like that. But like, I think what you're experiencing is the average case, which is you don't always get instantly a new one. And I haven't heard of anybody getting a full new boxed AirPod. They always want to replace one bud, two buds, or the case separately. And my kids have destroyed many AirPods, and I've gotten many warranty repairs, and always they replace the part that they think is broken. Never have I gotten brand new stuff. But
and to be clear, I would have been perfectly happy if they sent me away with a right AirPod and all my old stuff and got it to the point that I could at least repair them with my device. I would have been over the moon happy about that.
You wouldn't have been over the moon happy because remember my story of my son going in, I think it was 4 total times for a very similar problem, because in each one of those times they sent him away with a new thing, and each one of those times the new thing didn't quite work and he had to come back and go round and round. So, you know, Fair. Sometimes sending it away and having it get done for real for good in one trip is better than 4 individual trips where the person at the store makes a decision in the moment and says, I think it's probably just the right AirPod, and then you go back and say, I think it's still the right AirPod, and they replace it again. Now let's replace the left AirPod, and they replace it again. Now replace the case and they replace it again. That's not better.
Yeah, and I don't argue with anything you said. I know I'm going to be eviscerated after this airs because everyone's going to say I'm being a big baby, which is arguably true. But the whole point in Apple and Apple Care is to make it right and make it right. I think it should be made right relatively quickly. And again, just a right AirPod.
3 to 5 business days, not quick enough?
No, not when there's an Apple store right there with a gazillion AirPods sitting
in
the store.
Maybe if you'd paid $10,000 for a Mac Pro, I can see your complaints.
Oh, God, it all comes back to the fucking Mac Pro.
3 to 5 business. But it's like, it's their one of their least expensive products that they sell a bazillion of. They break all the time, so... I think 3 to 5 business days. It's not great, but, you know, at this point, I would rather have them fix it once in 3 to 5 business days than have to return to the store multiple times.
Your story is a failure of Apple Care, as far as I'm concerned. Like, that should never have happened.
Yeah, that used to be the way it was that you didn't get the, okay, we'll give you all a new one, until you'd gone back 3 to 5 times, or they had some, like, metric or, like, it,
which
like
is fair.
Have this.
Which is fair. And again, like, I feel like I'm coming across as saying, I want a brand new full package AirPods, you know, with the upgraded case and the whole, all that. Yes, I would like that, but that's not what I expect by any stretch of the imagination. I think it's perfectly reasonable if they send me back my old AirPods case, my old left AirPod in a repaired or replaced right
one. What makes you think it's the AirPod and not the case?
I don't know. Just because the left side seems to be fine, so why is it
because
the case?
Because the case is not charging the right side.
I mean, yeah, you could be right. I don't know. But it's frustrating when I feel like I do everything I can never to speak to Apple in this capacity anyway. And then
we just yell at them from here.
Right. Well, basically, I do everything I can to try not to engage with Apple. And I never say, like, look at me and my big podcast, which honestly isn't that big. I didn't even whip out the I'm an iOS developer, so I actually know what I'm doing, because in this context, I kind of don't know what I'm doing. But it's just frustrating that this is the experience I have. And I'm frustrated that these AirPods are, I mean, don't make me say planned obsolescence, but it's hard not to sometimes, even though I do think that's BS. It's sometimes hard not to. But I don't know. I feel like, you know, the terms of Apple Care, it used to be in years past that you could basically walk in and basically come out with an often refurbished, which is perfectly fair, but a replacement device. I remember going to Apple Care and saying, look, I have a reasonably bad scratch on my phone. Would you fix it, please? I said, absolutely. And then a couple of years later, Mike went and they said, absolutely not. And he got all grumpy about it, which I completely agree with. And then I tried the same thing. I was like, well, he was in the UK, I'm in America. Hey, you know, I have this phone and I've got Apple Care on it. And it's got a handful of scratches on it. Can I replace it? And they said, well, no. Well, huh? Well, so if I step outside and shatter it, would you replace it? And I told the story on the show. Well, yeah, but as long as we don't see you. And I didn't do that because I'm not that evil, but I really, really, really thought about it. And it's just when the terms are getting that onerous, I think I can say that
onerous?
Word. Onerous. Damn it. I threw it in R. It doesn't exist. Anyways, I'm very tired. I was at a concert last night. I'm very tired. When the terms are that onerous, in my personal opinion, then I can't help but wonder, why am I doing this in the first place?
Well, I mean, you've always got the option of, you know, the other option that will get you fast service.
It's just buying new pair.
Is don't get Apple Care, and when your things go wonky, buy brand new ones.
And I think
you save the money. Like, again, what I think the point of Apple Care, like any insurance, is not paying the full cost out of pocket when something goes wrong. That is the point of insurance. And you can quibble about how quickly they do that and if they do it in a manner of your liking. But if you don't like the time that they take to do it or the way the service does, you can buy yourself brand new AirPods real fast.
And honestly, that, to build on what you're saying, and I absolutely agree with you, to build on that, though, if the Phantom theorized brand new ones, like the AirPods Pro 3, that I think there was recently some hints of that in software somewhere, if the AirPods Pro 3 were available today, I would already have them in my hands.
I mean, that's true. Even if these twos were still working, probably. Let's be honest.
probably yes, actually, probably right. But the only reason I took them in is because I'm trying to just hold on.
Yeah,
until...
I mean, that's the thing about Apple Care. It's like, even if you're on there, well, I don't buy Apple Care. If I need to get new ones, I'll just pay for them myself. But if you know when the new products are coming out and you're close to it, you're like, oh, I didn't get Apple Care, and I also really don't want to buy new twos right before the threes come out. So yep. You know, there's another function of insurance / Apple Care for you. It lets you avoid that sticky situation as well in exchange for waiting 3 to 5 business days. And speaking of business days, one of my big HomePods is now out for repair.
Oh, tell me more.
They repair them?
Somebody does. I'll talk when I get it back. I'll tell you about it.
You're sending it to that guy who does the capacitor fix on YouTube?
Well, I don't know which person it is, but it's one of those people. Although, interestingly, I've got all these HomePods in my house. I got my original one and Marco's too that he sent me. And I don't think I ever wrote down, like, the serial numbers of which one is mine versus which two are Marco's. So I sent one of them in. I think I sent mine in, but I might be wrong. But anyway, we'll see how it turns out.
Anyway, in summary, I recognize fully that this is, I want to repeat it because I can hear all the angry emails and all the angry tweets. I get that this is low stakes. I get that there are much more important things that matter. It's just frustrating, and I need somewhere to yell and scream into the ether. And so you two provide me that platform by which I can yell and scream into the ether, and I feel better having released this anger. So thank you for indulging me, and thank you for not writing me and telling me how much of a self-centered jerk I am. So I appreciate you.
Well, hopefully after your 3 to 5 business days, what you will get back is a fully functional working set of AirPods, because if you don't, doing that 4 times is really going to suck.
Oh, yeah. That would not be fun at all. And then, I mean, I was extremely patient, extremely kind with the gentleman that I was working with, who in turn was extremely patient and extremely kind. Like, I have no complaints about the person I was speaking with. And I did gently ask, like, hey, you can't just like give me a new one, like, or like a replacement one right here. And he basically said, tough nuts, not happening. And I didn't argue. I said, okay, understand. I appreciate your time. But if I go through what Alex went through, I will be going full Chad, full Chad. It'll not be good. All right. What else we have left? Do you have to thank our sponsors?
Yeah, I was going to ask. Okay, we're going to go right to that. Okay. 1 minute.
Oh, wait, do we want to ask ATP? I feel like we don't.
No, but... I think it's a little late for that. All right.
Yeah, okay.
All right, thanks to our sponsors this week, HelloFresh and Notion. And thanks to our members who support us directly. You can join us at atp.fm/join. One of the many perks of membership is ATP Overtime, our weekly bonus topic. You think you, if you have not had enough of us, which I know that's how everybody feels all the time, right? You haven't had enough of us. You just need to hear more of this. You can do that by joining atp.fm/join, and you will hear Overtime every single week, plus bonus topics and bonus content like we talked about earlier with our member specials. This week on Overtime, we're going to be talking about 2020 hindsight. Looking back on some what was going on with John G. and Andrea on Apple and AI in 2020 with today's eyes. It'll be kind of fun. So join atp.fm/join to hear that and everything else. Thank you so much, and we'll talk to you next week.
All right. What do we got for after show?
F1, right?
Ah, yes. Okay. So, John, you did something that I didn't expect that you would do. You went and saw a movie about Formula One.
Well, yeah, it's so hot in the summer. You just want to be in an air-conditioned theater. Really, honestly, I don't see a lot of movies in the theater these days, just because I pay for every streaming service in the entire universe and have a big fancy TV, and that's what I prefer to do. But I often get frustrated by how long I have to wait for movies to come from the theater to be available on streaming in any fashion. So that's annoying. That's why I end up sometimes paying ridiculous fees. Like I just watched Thunderbolts recently, because it got some medium middle of the road reviews, and you could rent it for $25 or buy it for $29. So I bought it. It was okay. It was fine. Anyway, so why did I choose to see? Why did I choose to see F1 in the movie theater? And no, it wasn't the ad in Apple Wallet that pushed me over the edge.
Did supplies last?
Yeah, supplies did in fact last. I was always going to watch it, and I could have easily waited for it to be available on streaming. If is it already available on streaming? I don't know what Apple's theatrical window for it is. But anyway, this is the type of movie I thought, you know what? To give this movie the best chance of being the most enjoyable, it's the type of movie that I want to actually see in a dark theater on a really big screen with a giant sound system, because it's that kind of movie. It's like from the director of Top Gun Maverick. It's going to be, you know, big, loud, and fast and flashy. So I want to give this movie the best possible chance to wow me and for it to be enjoyable. And that's why I chose to see this in the movie theater. Now, I'm not into F1 at all. I've never even watched Drive to Survive. It's not a thing that I'm into. But I was going to watch this on streaming, we wanted to go see a movie. We wanted to be in the air conditioning. I said, this is what we should see. It's a perfect opportunity. So I went and saw it in a fancy theater.
Now, I'm sorry. You don't care for F1. Do you know anything about F1 at all?
They drive cars really fast around. I know a lot about F1 cars because in the YouTube channels that I watch, inevitably all my watching of supercars and hypercars inevitably leads you to F1 technology and videos and stuff. So I have seen a lot of that stuff from that perspective, but never touching on like the sport competitive part of it. Or I don't know the team names. I don't know the driver names. I don't know any of that. It's all just about like, how do they build the carbon ceramic brakes? And why do they have these little pointy spikes on them? And like, I know that stuff, but no interest whatsoever in the sport part of it, but like whatever, like it's a movie, so you know I'm gonna see an exciting movie. And I had heard from people who do know F1 and like F1 that the movie is a reasonable representation for even to someone who doesn't follow the sport of like, this is not entirely like, oh, the sport is nothing like this movie. If you watch this and you get some idea of what the sport is like. Obviously, it's not, you know, a movie starring Brad Pitt or whatever, but like that it was somewhat representative. Again, I wasn't watching it to convince me to like F1. I just wanted to see a good movie.
So I went on a field trip this afternoon by myself, and I went to the theater and I watched the F1 movie because there was no freaking way that you were going to talk about this movie. And even though you kindly offered to make a no spoiler review segment, which is what we're going to aim for, I didn't want there to be any risk of you slipping up. Not because I think this movie really justifies like a full media blackout, Todd Vaziri style, but just because I really wanted to go in cold. And so I also watched the movie this afternoon and I have thoughts. And one thing I will say is that I think you're right. Is this exactly accurate to perfection? Is this exactly how F1 works? No. Is it close enough? Is it, as they say around these parts, is it good enough for government work? Absolutely, yes. There are some details that are wrong. It's fine. The point of the movie, to have made it perfect would have been to make the movie worse, which is exactly what you would expect. It was fine in the sense that it didn't take away from the movie. I didn't have the plumber problem. You know, it was close enough. It was good enough in terms of F1 accuracy. And broadly speaking, and again, I'm going to also aim for no spoilers, I loved it. I thought it was a great movie.
Well, so the first thing I'm going to say about it is after this show, I'm going to talk about the Apple product placement, which, you know, Apple makes a lot of media. They make a lot of TV shows, make a lot of movies. They're usually pretty good about not conspicuously putting Apple stuff everywhere. Yeah, the good guys have iPhones and the bad guys don't, like whatever, but like it's not that conspicuous. This, I thought, was one of the more conspicuous examples of product placement, because at one point they were showing, I think, the design department for our Heroes F1 team, where they work on the car and the aerodynamics and stuff. And they had a bunch of Pro Display XDRs connected to Mac Studios. Yes, I was sad not to see Mac Pros, but, you know, they probably wouldn't have fit on the screen. They're so freaking big, or they'd be under the desk.
But they have wheels. What a perfect tie-in.
Exactly. Yeah, they'd be racing around. But there was one or two conspicuous shots of, like, that's a lot of XDRs on screen. And, you know, well, F1 teams have a lot of money, so it kind of fits. Although, obviously, the software they were running probably is Windows only or Linux only.
Well, I couldn't believe that Brad Pitt's choice of headphones, which was AirPods Max, that made sense. But they were stickered to Kingdom Come, and he seemed to be, like, on the verge, or maybe did actively get them wet a few times, like, underwater.
He definitely did get them wet. I thought of Merlin. I'm like, you know, those
aren't
really
right.
Waterproof. But, you know, he's whatever. Yeah, the stickers I thought was cute. But so there was a little bit of that. As for the movie, I think I'm glad I saw it in the theater, because I think it did benefit. It got like a 5 to 10% boost of just like movie experience, because no matter how, my sound system is not that great in the house, but like this has got car engines and roaring things, and just you need to really be immersed in that. And so that did give it a little bump. What I would say of this movie is that it is, in my opinion, ever so slightly above average in almost everything. There's a couple things that are a little bit below, there are a couple things that are a little bit above, but overall it is slightly above average, a slightly above average execution of a tried and true formula. Again, I'm not going to spoil it. If you've seen any movies like this at all, you will not be shocked by what happens in this movie, but you know what? That formula exists for a reason, and it works. I am a staunch defender of quote-unquote formula movies that execute really well on that formula. A lot of my favorite movies are like that. This one executes pretty well on the formula. Importantly, it doesn't do any huge, disastrously wrong things that would really drag it down for me. And I've seen this a lot in a lot of media. Some people have heard, refer to it derisively. I think Merlin has said this as like B+ media. I got nothing against a B+. Like it's kind of like frame rate in a video game. As long as there's no big dips, if you're a little bit above average in everything you do, that's a good movie. And so if you have any interest at all in movies like this, not in F1, I don't care about F1. But if you have any interest in movies like this, then let's name some movies like this. You could just go with the car racing movies. Even like something like Ford versus Ferrari, or your favorite Days of Thunder, or Top Gun Maverick, or The Karate Kid, or any sports movie. Like, if you like that kind of movie, this is a pretty good version of that kind of movie. And if you don't know anything about F1, like I don't, you will learn things about F1 from this movie, because the movie does, one of the things that I think is slightly below average is the movie does bend over backward to make the announcers say things that I assume the announcers would never say, because fans of F1 already know this stuff, but they have to, yes. As you know, Bob, by doing X, Y, and Z, P, Q, R, like... Yeah, well, I know this is someone who, you know, when I watch tennis, for example, they don't explain things like that. They assume you know what they're talking about. And if you watch a lot of tennis, you will learn this stuff through osmosis, but you don't have time in a two-hour movie to learn this through osmosis. So they have the announcers somewhat painfully explain the, and I need, to be clear, I needed them explained because I didn't know this, but I also knew that I was being explained to. And I can imagine if you know stuff about F1, you might be like, why? But anyway, it doesn't matter. This is what I say of this movie. Despite all the controversy about the ads or whatever, this is a thoroughly average to above average execution of a tried and true formula. And it benefits from being seen in the theater. So if you want to escape the heat and get into the air condition, I recommend checking it out. Don't expect The Godfather or something. But if you like Top Gun Maverick, I think you'll like this.
I don't know if I agree with that. I need to watch it again. I will be the first to watch Top Gun Maverick again. I didn't care for it. It was so...
I didn't like Top... I thought Top Gun Maverick was a worse movie than this, to be clear. But it's if that kind of thing appeals to you, like the dazzle, the spectacle, and the formula, this will also appeal.
I see what you're going for, but I get so turned off by you comparing this to Top Gun Maverick.
Well, I compare it to the original Top Gun, which I think the original Top Gun is a better movie than this. But I would lump them in the same category. Did it make me more interested in F1? Not really, but I like cars and I like fast cars. And I think they did, one of the things they did above average is showing a bunch of cars going faster on a track, which sounds boring, but with the application of modern technology, you can do that in a slightly different way than has been done in the past. I'm not saying the way they did it is better than like the way they did in Days of Thunder. It's just informed by modern technology and allows for a different look. And I thought it was cool.
Yeah, no, I broadly agree with everything you're saying. This is the standard, you know, the standard sports movie. I don't want to give even the hint of a spoiler. It's the standard sports movie. It is Days of Thunder all over again.
But although I will give credit. I see this is like a spoiler. Maybe we should have a special spoiler after. There's one thing that I will give this movie credit for. That it did. I mean, I didn't expect it. It was just because I was being dumb. And once the movie started, I'm like, oh, of course they're going to do it this way. But I think it made it a better movie. I guess I'll talk about it in the after show so the bootleg people will hear it.
Yeah, that's a good plan. Let's do it. Let's do just a touch of spoilers in the post show. Anyways, with regard to the movie, though, I thought it was really well done. Yeah, there were times, like a great example of this is DRS, which is drag reduction system. And the way this works is if you're within 1 second of the car in front of you, in certain parts of the track, the rear wing of the F1 car, which is there for several reasons, but especially downforce to give the car better handling. Well, that wing kind of acts like an air brake almost, because it's horizontally, you know, behind the car, and it's a bunch of air is hitting it. It's slowing the car down. So at certain times, if you are within 1 second of the car in front of you, then you can engage DRS, which is to say that wing will open up. There's a little flap that opens up, so the air will pass straight through the wing, and you get like something like 10 or 20 miles an hour faster by doing that. And when they explain DRS, they like super close up shots of the wing with the flap opening, and you hear the announcer say DRS two or three times and then explicitly say drag reduction system. This is what John is talking about. It was very like, you know, as you said, you know, oh, like, as you would know, Bob, that's the drag reduction system. You know, you are right. But I thought as that goes, it was a not particularly cringe way of doing that. It is still a bit cringe, but it wasn't that bad.
I already knew about DRS because that is a thing that's often referenced in hypercars, and they come with their own version of that because, of course, hypercars can do things that F1 cars cannot because of all those darn rules they have in F1.
Right. But the other thing that I thought this movie executed exceedingly well on is it was trying to paint itself as a movie of this minute, or maybe last year, if you will, insofar as this is current at Formula One in circa 2023 to 2025.
Yeah, most of the cameos were lost to me. I recognize one person.
And all of these cameos. Now, some of these people have since left F1, like Gunter Steiner has a couple of very brief bit parts where he's the guy who basically leans back from the pit wall to look at the star trio of the or maybe it's four of them, the two people that are talking on the radio, the head lady.
I have
lady.
No memory of the scene because I have no idea who this person is.
That's fine. It doesn't matter. But he's no longer in F1. He was formerly a team principal. He's not in F1 anymore. The teams have been rejiggered at least once since this was recorded. But all of that being said, they had enough participation from actual Formula One and actual Formula One drivers and actual Formula One team principals and so on that it read as real. But they were also smart enough not to go too deep into that because Formula One drivers, team principals, they're not actors. There was one scene.
And it's a made up team too, by the way.
And it's a made up team.
It's like a baseball movie where they're playing the Yankees, but the team is like I was trying to make up a fake baseball team, but I'm afraid it would be like a Florida team, but it's a made up, it's a made up team.
The Sasquatches or whatever.
Yeah. Cause if you do a makeup team, no one's going to get as mad at you as if you were like, oh, he's the driver for McLaren. It's like, oh, now you've got a bunch of problems.
Right. And so, they did a really good job of giving enough nods to make it feel like it's real while not going completely out of control and having like extended scenes with these people who are clearly not actors. The closest they came was a meeting with a couple of team principals. There was Zach Brown from McLaren. There was the dude from Ferrari, whose name is escaping me. And the fake team's team principal and the other two guys on that couch, like they are real honest goodness team principals. I thought they did a great job. Granted, they had like a line each, so it wasn't hard. But that's what I'm talking about. Like they leveraged F1 appropriately.
And they were playing themselves and talking about F1, so you think they'd do okay.
Yeah, exactly. This is, you know, you've seen Tim get better at acting ish over the years. And, you know, these gentlemen did a pretty good job. So, you know, I really loved how well they thread that needle. I thought it was extremely well executed. The in-car scenes, to your point, the tech has gotten better since Ronin, since Days of Thunder, since all of these other movies that are classic car movies.
Yeah, and even Ford versus Ferrari took a different approach, similar tech, but different approach than this movie took.
Yeah, and I think the director, was it Joe Kaczynski or something like that, got a little aggressive with like the 180 crash twists. I'm sorry, Todd, I don't know the right term for it, but you'll be like looking at the driver of the car and then he'll like slam the camera 180 degrees the other way, so you're looking out the front of the car. That was very heavy-handed in this movie, but it was a cool effect and I liked it a lot. This I really enjoyed this movie. Admittedly, I was predisposed to enjoy this movie. I thought it was really well done.
And anything, you're predisposed not to like it because whenever I watch tennis movies, I can't stand them because they screw it up so bad. So you would be the harshest critic. You actually know stuff about F1. So it's a testament to this movie's accomplishment that you weren't going like, oh, they got it all so wrong.
Yeah, I think the biggest problem I have with this movie was how is Brad Pitt that astonishingly attractive at like 62 years old? It's not fair.
I guess I should find this in the show notes. Speaking of Brad Pitt, there was a YouTube video that of course was chucked in my face because of everything that I'm doing, and I somehow knew that I watched this movie. Anyway, whatever, I blame Apple. Where Brad Pitt goes out in an actual F1 car on the course, and you get to see him actually driving it.
Yeah, well, they had this in the Vision Pro. It's incredible. It's absolutely incredible. Yeah,
although I do enjoy watching the actor Brad Pitt try to drive a very expensive car very carefully. It's very different than his character in the movie. He's like, just seeing his every second he's out there, he's like, do not crash this multi-million-dollar car. Do not crash this car.
Either way, though, I thought the movie was really well done. And I forgot to bring up, there was another bit of product placement that you didn't talk about. In the very beginning of the film, I think when we meet the owner of the F1 team, not the boss, mind you, but the guy who owns it, who is played by Javier Bardem, we see Brad Pitt in a laundromat and he's playing a pinball machine. And I almost fell right the hell out of my chair because that exact same pinball machine in much worse shape is in my house as we speak. I almost died. I almost freaking died.
That's awesome.
Which was incredible. And the name of the pinball machine is Grand Prix. But I almost fell out of my chair. I immediately grabbed my phone and took a picture and sent it to Aaron because I was like, oh my God, you will not believe what just happened. Which only matters to me, and I recognize that, but I just thought it was incredibly funny and incredibly cool. Now, I would like
Aaron's
to talk...
Like, now we're never getting rid of this thing.
Yeah, right, exactly. I would like to talk spoilers again in the post-post show, but all told, I think this is an enjoyable movie. If you will permit me I think the summary of the plot, which is kind of hinted at, this is if you mash together, so skip like 20 seconds if you're not interested. If you mash together Days of Thunder and Cars, the animated movie 3, and put them together, that's the plot. Now, to you, that might sound terrible, but to me, that's great because I love both those movies. And I think that the combination of the two, it really worked for me. I really enjoyed the movie. Yes, like my friend Brian, who's the kind of the reason I'm into F1, and he's been watching F1 since I've known him in the early 2000s. I'm confident that he would hate every second of this movie because he would be too particular about it. But I went into it wanting it to be at least realistic enough, and otherwise I was going to let it wash over me. And it was exactly that. It was great. I loved it. And I presume it will show up on Apple TV Plus, so you can watch it at home. And although I concur with John, you should go to the theater and see it. But if you're, you know, kind of about it, then just wait until you can watch it at home and then watch it on the biggest, loudest system you can and just let it wash over you and you'll enjoy it. All right. Do you want to do the bootleg stuff now, or you want to wait until right before the post show?
Let me just do the bootleg stuff now before we do titles. It'll be quick, I think. This is spoiler territory, so if you're listening to the bootleg, don't want to know anything about the movie, just like skip forward several minutes. anyway, the thing that occurred to me quickly when I was watching the movie that did not occur to me until I started watching the movie because I'm old and dumb is that, like, I expected, like, so Brad Pitt's on the poster. He's the star of the movie. He's going to be driving things or whatever. I'm like, okay, well, he's going to be a good driver and he's going to take this team that was losing and make them better because he's a good driver. And then as soon as I watched the movie, I said, oh, wait, Brad Pitt is old now. And so you can't put him in the movie and be like, here he comes to save the day. 20 years ago, you could do that with Brad Pitt, but Brad Pitt now is super old. So you have to embrace that. And the movie totally does. The movie's like, who is this old guy who thinks he's going to drive an F1 car? Because this is a thing that, even though I don't follow F1 at all, one thing I do know, again, because of all my other car-related stuff, is that driving an F1 car is incredibly physically demanding. Not just like, oh, you get tired and you're sweaty. No, I mean, like, physically, regular people can't do it because they're not strong enough. Why? G-forces. Really hard brake pedals, which I think they could boost more. But anyway, like, as you will see when you see Brad Pitt drive the actual F1 car, we'll put the link in the show notes, he's actual actor Brad Pitt is not either not strong enough or not brave enough to press the brake pedal as hard as you have to. No normal people are. Like, it's like being a fighter pilot. Like, regular people can't do it. And that's something people don't appreciate about F1 drive. But anyway, in the movie, even though he's not Brad Pitt, he's this, you know, person who did drive F1, he is old. So it would be, you know, it's like the movies where they have like someone who's like 60 years old and he's the romantic lead to a 20-year-old, and you're like, this doesn't really work. Like, I know he used to be that person, but he's not. But in this movie, they're totally like, no, he's old and he is not going to be as good or as fast as the young people because he's old. And the movie 100% embraces that. And then it got into all the ways that he helps the team, which required them painfully explaining rules about how F1 works that, you know, it's maybe some tracks in the movie because it is more realistic of how he could help the team, but is also convoluted because the rules are convoluted, but the movie explains it. Don't worry about it. But anyway,
the rules are awful, but yes,
that right. I just didn't think, I saw the poster. He's so fit. I'm like, oh, it's Brad Pitt. He's going to be the hero. It's like, no, he's the old hero. All you people, you know, from your childhood are now old and they have to play the old person in the movie. There is a hotshot kid. It ain't Brad Pitt and he's not as old as Brad Pitt.
Yeah, and I will also say, again, spoilers, like big spoilers, I expected this to be more like Cars 3, wherein what happens is Brad Pitt has to sideline himself in order to get the young buck the victory. And I was absolutely shocked that that was not the way the movie ended. And that's already pretty much a spoiler.
They do a good job of that. I think the story, that's one of the great things about the movie. Having a story that doesn't go below average, that doesn't do something dumb, really counts for a lot in my book. And this story is competently constructed. Not too many twists. Like, it doesn't make the mistake of trying to make Brad Pitt the young hero who's going to solve everything. It doesn't make him too ridiculously bad. It tries to walk that middle path and still have enough interesting turns and twists to be realistic. That's a difficult thing to do. So kudos to the people who wrote this movie for correctly aligning script and the age of their star.
Yeah, no, I really thought it was well executed. I know you seem tepid on it, but I really enjoyed it quite a lot.
These days, if you are average or a little bit above, that's pretty good in my book.
sorry, Marco, for spoiling everything.
I'm never going to watch it.
Yeah. Titles. You might,
titles.
You might like it, although, again, I think you'd like it better in the theater.
It'd certainly be cooler in the theater, I can tell you that.
Yeah, exactly.
All right, where are my titles?
I hope he got my Mac Pro shirt.
That is good. Bargain Basement Liquid Glass is pretty good, although that was about YouTube, wasn't it? Hot Spare CEO, I suggested, but I love that.
Didn't we already have that title of an episode?
Ah, damn it, did we?
We might have.
Yeah, I made that joke like a year or two ago.
All right. Yeah. My Life is Filled with Amateur Theories. That was a Marcoism, but it was very good.
Kind of like Part of the Movement.
I mean, I suggest it, so I'm not going to say no.
What was that context?
It was, YouTube being part of the movement by saying, we have a liquidish, glassish thing. We're part of the movement.
I think I like Mac Pro Shirt better.
No, I don't want to do the Mac Pro Shirt one. I need him to embrace the shirt and wear the shirt and love the shirt and not be distracted by titles.
Obviously, he pays attention to all of our episode titles.
Yeah, right.
Yeah,
I think Part of the Movement is good.
Yeah, it's fine.
All right, well, we're going to go with that.
All right, cool.
And I need you to vamp for a minute because I got to clean up my show notes a little bit. So we can either vamp for the live people or we can vamp before the bootleg, but I need a minute here.
Okay. Well, I guess, because we're going into overtime now. So, I guess that's it for live people. We are live next...
Monday.
Right. Yes, Monday the 21st, so next Monday. We'll be live next.
Next week we're Monday and Thursday, and then there's another week vacation for Casey and I, and then we're back.
I'm looking forward to... On Tuesday, I'm going to my annual Fish concert.
Whereabouts?
They're playing in Queens. So it's
annual? Nice. Haven't you done more than one so far in the last 12 months?
I went to Goose in the spring. Was it spring?
Didn't you go to a Fish one when you were telling us like your plug reviews?
I mean, and at this point I'm doing that like once or twice a year. Right. But I went, the last one I went to was Goose, and that was in, I believe, the fall, like the somewhere around September, October. Yeah, turns out the spring has been all restaurant stuff.
Imagine that.
Yeah.
John, why? Missing HTTPS prefix on the following markdown link URLs, blank. Damn it, John.
Hey, if you've got a reproducible bug report, I will fix it.
Well,
file the example project.
I can't say... All right, well, I'm not
saving
this.
Just select all in the text field and then paste it into a text document and say, hey, when I put this text in a complaint, that's your reproduction. Just copy and paste that text into a text document and mail it to me. That's it.
Yeah, do we have a bug tracker?
No, I'm the bug tracker. Just mail it to me. Mail me that text file. I will know.
I just sent it. It's in Slack.
All right, there you go.
All right.
Didn't even have to send an email.
By the way,
you've inlined it in Slack?
Yeah, I did.
Oh, God.
You're welcome.
I hope it's not a white space thing. How do I download this? I guess I could select.
All right, hold on. Terminal.
Zip it. You have to protect everything with zip.
Shut up. All right. PB paste greater than sign tilde desktop. Here, John, are you happy? .txt. And then I will find that file. It is now also in.
You have to zip it. I said you told me to shut up, and I said zip it. This is why I was telling you to zip it.
God damn it. I hate you, John. I hate you so much.
That's the main purpose of zip is protecting documents from stupid apps that demand to inline everything.
But at least the .txt, you can just click download. Like, you don't have to zip it.
I tried to do that can I do it? Let me see. Is it a .dot menu? Pin to channel, get notified. Anyway, I don't think you can download it.
We can push Zapier.
Here you are. Whatever that means. John, are you happy? .txt.
Yes, I'm very happy. I will have that fixed for you tomorrow.
I bet you it's something I'm doing wrong. I don't doubt it, but
it should never say blank. That's a bug.
Right. Oh, thank you. Then say we agree.
I mean, there still might be a problem with the text, but the error message should be more informed.
Right. We're saying the same thing. I bet you the text does have an issue for sure, but I don't know where it is.
You didn't find it yet?
No, I'm not looking right now. I'm trying to talk to you.
I know, but you got to hit save.
I can't because it won't let me. That's the problem.
You got to at least get you got to work around the bug before while I fix it.
All right, hold on, hold on. I have now hit save.
Just do a binary search, like cut out half of them.
See if it saves.
That's the way you do it. All right, it is saved. See, this is what people pay us for. All right, I think we are good now. Right. You've done the compulsory amounts of vamping. Yes. Thank you, live people. We'll see you. What did you say, Monday and Thursday, something like that? I was only half listening.
Monday and Thursday.
Oh, I think I found the error.
Oh, what was it?
See, look at that. I didn't have the binary search or anything. I just look at it with my eyeballs. Vision Pro Brad Pitt ride along. Close parens with nothing between the parens.
Fair. That's because I haven't found the friggin' link yet because nobody links to the
right,
damn
but that,
thing.
That's what it would say. Hey, this link does not begin with HTTP. And it's true, it doesn't. It's empty.
You should include the error message.
I'll fix the error message, but I'm just saying, like, it's not the failure case is just, you know, not catching an edge case with an explicit error message. But
yep, that you are right. That and I thought it would be my fault, but it was also not entirely.
I'll fix it tomorrow.
Bye, all right, thanks, people. Dear. Bye, life people.